comes around.
I guess, I wonder.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's Monroe City Council meeting. This is the Monroe City Council meeting for October 27th, 2015. The time right now is 7 p.m. Ms. Smoot, will you please call the roll?
Certainly. Council members present and establishing a quorum are Hanford, Cuddeback, Rasmussen, Camp, Davis, and Gearing.
Thank you. And we heard from Councilmember Gamble last week that he would be out this evening, so unless there's opposition, we will consider him as excused. Will everybody please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. First item that we have on this evening's agenda is under announcements and presentations. This is the first item and the only item under that, and this is AB 15188, East Monroe Draft Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement. Mr. Osaki.
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, as you know, in 2013, the city council passed two ordinances, one dealing with a comprehensive plan amendment from limited open space to general commercial for 43 acres of property, commonly known as East Monroe. And as part of that, there was also a concurrent zone change from limited open space also to general commercial for those same 43 acres. That council action was appealed to the Growth Management Hearings Board. The Hearings Board basically invalidated the ordinances. It invalidated the rezone ordinance and invalidated that portion of the comprehensive plan amendment ordinance that was specific to the map amendment for that 43 acres. And in making that decision, the board found that the city's environmental work addressing the issue of the environment and how the proposed non-project action for a comprehensive plan amendment and rezone could affect the environment was lacking and needed more work. The city response to that has been in the form of preparing a draft supplemental environmental impact statement. That supplemental environmental impact statement, and one of the key words is supplemental because it supplements the September 2013 final environmental impact statement that was prepared for this particular proposal. And the other key word is draft because it was released, that draft supplemental environmental impact statement was released at the end of August for a 30-day comment period. That 30-day comment period went to September 28th. We received comments and requests for an extension to that comment period. That comment period was extended until noon on October 9th. And as part of that process, the city also held, we didn't have to, but we held an opportunity for verbal comment. So on September 23rd of this year, the city held a public hearing on the draft supplemental environmental impact statement. You should have, as part of your packet, all the written comments that were submitted during that comment period, and you should also have the transcripts from that September 23rd public hearing. The next steps, as were outlined in an agenda bill, I think a few meetings ago, the City Council needs to consider the Planning Commission recommendation. And last night, the Planning Commission recommended denial of the comprehensive plan amendment, and they recommended denial of the rezone. So that would be the recommendation coming to this body from the Planning Commission. Between now and November 10th, we at the city, we need to issue the final environmental impact statement and the final supplemental environmental impact statement. And that responds in writing to comments that were verbal and in writing during that comment period for the environmental impact statement. And it also makes any adjustments to the environmental impact statement that we feel are warranted based on those comments. So tonight, the purpose of tonight is that we have the consultant team that worked on the environmental impact statement in September of 2013 that was issued and has also been working on the supplemental environmental impact statement to give you a briefing so that you have a sense as the council of the issues that were identified by the Growth Management Hearings Board, how they've been responded to in the draft supplemental EIS, some of the key issues that came up during the public comment period, and how those are being responded to in the final EIS, so that you have that information as the basis for your action that will come later in November. So that's a little longer than I was planning to speak, but at this point in time, I'll introduce Trish Natanis, and she'll actually introduce other members of the PACE consultant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, David. Good evening, Mr. Mayor, honorable council members. My name is Trish Natanis. I'm council for and I'm here on behalf of Heritage Baptist Church, the applicant.
and compliance participant in the East Monroe Comprehensive Plan Amendment and Rezone Proposal. Thank you very much for having us here tonight to brief you on the supplemental EIS that has been prepared in response to the growth board order, as David has just stated. I did take the opportunity to write a letter, a pre-briefing letter to you, introducing the SEIS as well as flagging some of the issues that have come up during the public process of this proposal. Wanted to get those things in front of you and have you be able to review it and consider it. Because we don't have a whole lot of time here, but if you do have any questions, I won't be able to cover every single thing that's there, but if you have any questions of me or any members of the team, please ask. We would be happy to address those. Before I turn it over to our team of consultants here, just a couple of brief remarks. Want to talk about why this SEIS was prepared, as David had mentioned a couple of things, but the growth board invalidated those two ordinances that you had passed previously and found some errors. The first error is that the city had failed to consider a reasonable range of alternatives. And two, that the city had failed to analyze environmental impacts and mitigation throughout the 43-acre site. Specifically, three topics under that second error, which is one, impacts to wetlands, to a stream, as well as salmon habitat. Secondly, flood hazards, and third, landslide risk. So the SEIS is targeted to address those specific issues and work in conjunction with that final 2013 EIS. Together, they make the necessary tool for you as the decision makers to consider the environmental impacts and mitigation of the proposal. The second thing I just want to mention quickly is to differentiate this proposal as a non-project action versus a project action. It is an important distinction to make in that the consideration of a non-project action such as here looks at the big picture. It is a comprehensive analysis of cumulative impact, of reasonable range of alternatives, of mitigation. It understands that it's a little bit more flexible because there is no specific and detailed information available yet. This is different than a project action where there's more detail, more information to consider, and those details and information and analysis are specific to that project. The SEPA and kind of our law really requires and encourages the focus of review to be on those things that are ready for review rather than those things that are not. So therefore, there's this two-step process in the review of this proposal. As a non-project action right now, and then later on, there would be another review for when a project comes in the door to be reviewed by this city as the reviewing agency, as well as David Asaki as the SEPA responsible official. I want to close by asking you to affirm your decision previously to ask for actions to be taken by Heritage in retaining PACE to take on this supplemental environmental impact statement, the preparation thereof, the substantial work and task to do that in order to comply with the growth board's order and findings of deficiencies to correct those deficiencies here. This team of people have worked very, very hard, very diligently to be able to meet, to be able to prepare this supplemental EIS under your direction. And let me introduce these folks to you. Susan Boyd, you've met before, I believe. She's the project lead on this. Scott Brainerd is the wetland scientist from Wetland Resources. Craig Herman from, he's a geoengineer, I'm sorry. And Larry Karpak, hydrologist from Watershed. Okay, and then if you have other, unless you have any questions for me, I'll turn it over to these folks to
thank you.
Go through the process.
Thank you.
Thank you, Treasurer. So I'm not quite sure how I start this. We have a kind of a slight PowerPoint. It's not actually that critical, but a few things here might trigger some memories and get us to where we are today. As Tristan said, we have some people here today, wetlands resources, watershed, and geoengineers, as well as people from the case engineers, to talk to you about what we've done for the subsequent EIS. A little bit of history. The reason it was approved by the council, it was put forth, it went through several different iterations of comment and appeal. Growth Management Hearing Board said, well, you might want to look at a couple of things in a little more detail, and that's what we've done. The SEIS is, again, supplementing the final EIS. Specific questions were asked, specific questions were answered by specialists. And, you know, I want to point out that, I don't know if you remember this, but we talked very in a lot of detail with the council and city staff about exactly what that scope of work should be. And we argued a little bit about it, and we came up with a scope of work that we thought really did address all the questions that were being asked, and those have been fulfilled in the SEIS. Just as a refresher, proposed action, 43 acres, about 11 are developable. Lots of area that's set aside for various critical areas and setbacks. Key issues. We needed to add a no action, no development alternative to clarify baseline conditions. That's been done. Look at potential impacts to the entire 43-acre site. We spent a lot of time in the SEIS on looking at landslide hazards from above. Not that they would that much of an impact on the lower property, but we did look at that. We looked at in further detail at the fill placement and the potential impacts associated with fill on the property. The impacts to habitat, future flooding, quite a bit of hydrologic modeling upstream, downstream, and just looking at how the property would react in a flooding situation. And this wasn't really by us, but the city did more of it. City staff did more of alternative commercial development sites within the city and looked at were there other places that commercial development could be located. We confirmed the developable area. I want to point out again that white sort of area, white plus blue hatched out, is non-developable. It's recognized. It's recorded as such as a native growth protection area. The applicant recognizes that. There's a lot of talk about the hillsides and whatnot, and I want to point out that the developable area is well outside of any critical areas ordinances for setbacks from the hillsides, the streams, the wetlands, and other critical areas. So again, 43 acres, 11 acres are developable. Thought I had more to say. But with that, unless there's questions, I'll turn it over to geoengineers to talk a little bit more about what they did to go up and look at the hillsides, make sure that there was that the hillsides were stable and evaluate the landslide potential there.
Thanks, Susan.
Hi, my name is Craig Erdman. I'm a senior engineering geologist with GeoEngineers based out of Redmond, Washington. To the council members and Mr. Mayor. Just as a brief introduction here, I just wanted to reiterate some of the credentials in the slide with the team members there. It showed me as a licensed geologist and a licensed engineering geologist with the state of Washington. I also wanted to kind of introduce you a little bit to Galen McAnally, who's not here tonight, but he is the principal in charge of this project, and he and I, our work experience goes back to grad school, so we've known each other for over 30 years and worked together for most of the last 20 years, and in that time, we have looked at several hundreds of landslides of not more, and we worked primarily in the Northwest where we gained our experience, and a lot of our experience has expanded out from there. So we evaluate a lot of landslides. We help our clients manage those landslide risks. We work for small and large companies. We work with single-family homeowners to mitigate their landslides, and I've done work all across the country up into Alaska and down to California. So one other thing that I'd like to point out is that both Galen and I are on the Washington State Department of Natural Resources qualified list of geotechnical experts for evaluating forest practice applications. And you have to have a certain amount of experience looking at steep slopes and how trees interact with those hill slopes, especially if you remove them and things like that. So just adds another little bit of experience there that and a qualification to what we are capable of. Our work was based on the agreed-to scope. It consisted of a combination of doing desktop review of available information, as well as doing a field reconnaissance, and then compiling all that information and synthesizing that with some of the information that came out of the hydraulic modeling. The assumptions are that the proponent is not doing anything on the hillside, they're not disturbing the channel itself, and basically any development that would subsequently occur is being done in accordance with the local critical area ordinance and other building codes. So, in summary, our findings are that there's no evidence, or there is evidence of shallow sliding on that hill slope above that is on the north side of the property and extends off site. And so that slope descends down to the property. We did not find evidence of what we would refer to as deep-seated landsliding. That's the type of landsliding that everybody has gotten really concerned about over the last year and a half, and you know, frankly, for the last 20 years in Western Washington here, we've had quite a few. A lot of which geoengineers, as well as Galen and myself, have been involved with. There's no impacts associated, based on our evaluation, with the proposed rezone, provided all the critical area ordinances are enforced at the time the development is proposed and reviewed. And then, just kind of more on a side note, you know, there has been a lot of tree clearing on that hill slope there, and that can have some impacts on slope stability there. And that is mostly off-site, but it is, it's a concern to everybody, no doubt about it. So, as I mentioned before, we completed our review in coordination with the hydraulic analysis, so we took a lot of look into all of these things. Let's see. Is it a button or do I need to push over here?
Probably over there. There you go.
What's that?
I can get that on the computer.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, so again, Here's kind of the overall approach here. Kind of went through this already. Office evaluation, so we're looking at published geologic maps, soil maps published by the Natural Resource Conservation Service. We're looking at any available reports on the area that we can find, including our initial letter that was prepared by others in our company. And then we also did a pretty comprehensive review of historical aerial photographs going back into the 1940s, and then using some more recent aerial imagery. We also looked at topographic maps, which are really important to geologists in terms of looking at the landforms and trying to identify potential landslides, especially significant ones that could really be of concern. And we worked in with PACE to develop some of the figures and so forth that we developed ultimately as a result of our work. Once we completed our office review, we went into the field to document the hill slope conditions that we could see from the proponent's property, accessing things as best we could. From that, we were able to identify some features that are indicative of slope movement, and also able to document some areas of seats within the project's property. And then ultimately brought all that information back, compiled it, and as I said, assembled it together and evaluated the information that we had. So this is a geologic map. I think the important thing to note here, this is the proponent's property outlined in black. This lower area is all alluvium, so it's river deposits. There's the channel that runs along the base of the slope. Most of this area is underlain by glacially consolidated materials, so they're pretty dense. They have pretty strong properties until they sit and weather, and they start to lose their strength as they get affected by the weathering near the surface. A couple of things I want to note, this upper part is outwashed, so it's looser material, but everything else is glacially consolidated other than the alluvium. This unit through here is called Vachon Advance Outwash, so it's a granular material. It tends to hold water, especially when it's underlain by other units that are less permeable, so they have a lot of clay content and fines and so forth. And so those are older glacial deposits. So we were not able to go up onto these areas to look at the slope in detail, but these are areas that certainly can have seeps and help promote landslide activity. But the other thing that I really want to point out here is this big feature here that was mapped by the State Department of Natural Resources, and this is a fairly large landslide area as they mapped it. And this feature certainly had us looking at things closely, because it has, as it's mapped, the shape and form of something that looked like it might be a deep-seated landslide. So what we ultimately did then is look at some of the other information, and I'll get into that shortly. But the bottom line is, we don't see any difference in that area as compared to any other site area on the site. So that's just kind of the main takeaway here. This is a soils map, so this basically shows the different soil units. This unit number 4 is alderwood, silty sand and gravel complex. It and the unit up on the top are both susceptible to erosion, so that's the main takeaway there. This map shows the slope gradients in the area. So these red areas are slopes that are greater than 40%, and 40% is basically kind of the one of the gradient or slope cutoffs in terms of gradients that starts demarking a steep slope that has a greater potential for landslide. So you can see this area through here along this entire hill slope is pretty much greater than 40% slope, except for maybe little areas here and there. But again, I guess the point is that, you know, if that one area was a large landslide, we would expect those steep slopes to come out here or maybe have a little bit of a bench through there. But it's a fairly uniform slope that we see. And of course, one of the last things we did before we went out, we looked at aerial photographs. This aerial photograph happens to be one that was taken about the time that we were finalizing our report. But it is kind of interesting to note one thing is the tree harvest that's been occurring, i.e. just tree falling. The other thing is that it does show this one landslide, active landslide, that we mapped and show in our report. And this is a photograph of that same landslide. When we were out on site, we used software that's on an iPad that allows us to actually map features, sketch features in the field onto a map base and take photographs and georeference the exact lake location from where those pictures were taken. So we feel pretty confident. You know, there's maybe a little bit of difference between what we presented and where things show on that aerial photograph, but the main point here is that what we see here is pretty typical of the processes that occur along this area's steep slope. And we don't really see much difference in this area from what might occur sometime along this entire hill slope over the course of time. And again, here's the location of some features that we mapped, some couple of shallow hand augers that we completed at the base of the slope. There's some seeps that you can see along close to that north boundary of the property line, and especially in the central and northeastern corner. And then a couple of landslides, the most recent one on the left, and then this interpreted older landslide, which is basically a vegetation clearing. We saw an area where there were fewer trees and so forth than adjacent areas. And then ultimately developed a formal landslide and erosion hazard map. And this is based on our observations in the field, the LIDAR-based map that we relied on, and a lot of geologists and scientists rely on for good topographic data and landform analysis. And so we have in the light tan the landslide hazard area. The stipple is the erosion hazard based primarily on slope and soil type. So that's just basically, and then there's a couple of small little areas of greater than 40% slope in that parcel D area that are greater than 10 feet in height. And again, just to kind of bring you back, this here's the geologic map again, but what I want to point out are these locations here of these three cross sections. So these are basically like slices into the earth, so we can kind of look at what is happening under the surface. And the main takeaway here is one, so this is cross section A. This goes through what was the mapped landslide area. The concern being that it was deep-seated, aka like Oso or something like that. And it really, this is a fairly planar slope. It does not have the what we call a concavo-convex slope. So you have kind of a curve that goes into the slope in the upper part, and then it comes out in the upper part or in the lower part of the slope. And it's really similar along here. Here's a slide that basically went through the most recent landslide. It's kind of sketched in there. It's, you know, it's a sketch and it's a kind of an approximation of what the landslide is and looks like in a profile view. And again, looking down on the next cross section C, more or less the same thing. Some slight variation in soil or the geologic units in the hill slope. And so, you know, again, based on the geologic mapping that's been completed by the state. The other thing that is on here are the flood elevations that are model as well as what is predicted for the existing condition. So in all three of these cross sections, you know, they do extend slightly up onto the hill slope based on this data. But you know, because of the velocities are fairly low, and there's fairly dense vegetation, especially along that toe area. You know, we don't see the cut banks that we would typically see in an area where we were concerned about undercutting the slopes by a stream. And from that perspective, you know, the risk is I mean, it's going to match what's already there. So. And then, again, there's evidence of previous shallow landsliding, no evidence of deep-seated landsliding that would suggest that, you know, the property would be inundated by a large landslide. No impact associated with the proposed rezone, the critical areas are enforced. And then, again, there's this concern that, you know, there are potential impacts upslope and downslope by removal of trees. Thank you.
Just a second.
Yes, sir.
Councilmember Camp.
Thank you. You mentioned LIDAR.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering first if you could explain that. And how is it used? I noticed you were talking about the slope was determined with LIDAR, and just in general, how it was used in the property or for whatever you used to determine.
Okay. So LIDAR stands for light detection and ranging. Hmm. And so the way that LIDAR is collected is from an aircraft that flies along, and it basically shoots a laser across the ground surface, and and that data reflects back to a sensor on the airplane, and they can, based on the time that it takes for that light to come back, they can measure a distance. And what happens, they run it through a massive computer, as you might imagine, because there's billions of points, and they can actually they take out what they call the first returns, and they run an analysis, and they can actually create what we see here, which is what we call a bare earth model. And so it gives us a pretty reasonable representation of the earth's surface over the area that they've flown, and they run like many tracks next to each other. And so what happens then is all those points, we create what's called a digital elevation model. So it's a grid of points. And then to develop the slope gradient map, we look at the elevation differences between each of those cells. These are 6 foot wide cells on each side, and see what the elevation difference is. And they figure out, you know, the horizontal distance between them is 6 feet. So if you got, you know, 3 feet of difference, then you got a 50% slope. And so, so that's how we develop the slope gradient map. But and then the other thing that we can do is we can create what's called a hill shape model, and that's effectively what you see behind the slope gradient map here, and that helps to illuminate what the ground surface is doing. And so, you know, so this light is typically coming in from the northwest side, and so that whole hillside right now is in the shade, which kind of helps to illuminate it and make it pop out a little bit more on this map. So so that's how we can tell kind of where slopes are and so forth.
Okay. I noticed one of the documents that said that there's a 0.6 foot, also roughly 7 inches,
mm-hmm.
of variance. Is that a plus or minus factor, or how accurate? I guess what I'm asking is how accurate is LIDAR? I have heard issues about brush, heavy vegetation. If you could speak to that.
Yeah, on a hard surface, LIDAR can be incredibly accurate, down to, you know, 3 or 4 inches. I mean, and the process has improved greatly over the last 10, 15 years that it's really been coming out here. you know, brushy areas certainly do have some impacts. I've certainly been on projects where, you know, I thought there was a berm and you go out there and it's just thick blackberries. And so you can see, you know, some effects from that. So, I mean, it's not perfect. You know, 6 inches in a grassy field is pretty darn good as far as I'm concerned, and forms a pretty reasonable basis for the hydraulic modeling that was done, in my opinion.
So also, do you, in case of heavy vegetation, do you go out there and do like a manual probe just to get a rough idea? You mentioned that if you had a blackberry bush and it shows up as a 10-foot elevation, would you go out there with a pole? How do you mitigate that? I'm just curious how you handle it.
Oh, in terms of looking at the LIDAR data?
Right. If you go out and you want to look at the reality of it, do you go out there and just do some mitigation?
As a geologist, we don't do that. I mean, we would use a probe probably just to verify perhaps that there's not solid ground within a foot or two or something like that sometimes. But typically, we're not out there with the survey rod and having somebody do another survey elevation measurement for us, but you know, we use our judgment when we take this data out in the field with us and understand that, you know, there can be anomalies in tree cover, especially evergreen tree cover. You know, you get a lot fewer returns back from the ground, and so the data sometimes looks kind of funky, and you kind of get an idea of just over time, based on experience, how confident you feel about that data.
How confident do you feel about this data?
This data looks pretty good to me. I mean, for the purpose of what we're doing, it's pretty darn good.
All right. You
know, there are some things in here that seem to be consistent with some of the map geology. I don't know Joe Dragovich, who mapped this squad, took advantage, had this data when he was mapping, but there's kind of this bench through here that looks like it probably corresponds with a geologic contact, so it's a more resistant layer. So I think it's pretty good.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, I'm Larry Karpak with Watershed Science and Engineering. I'm a professional hydrologist, professional engineer. I've been, just to give some background on my credentials, I've been doing hydraulic engineering here in the Pacific Northwest for 25 years. The last 5 years have been with my own company, Watershed Science and Engineering. The previous 20 was with a company, Northwest Hydraulic Consultants, in Tukwila, Washington, which will be relevant to some of the stuff I'll talk about tonight. Specifically, one of the things that I'm going to talk about a little bit is the preliminary FEMA mapping. And while I was at Northwest Hydraulic Consultants, I was the manager for the work done to produce the preliminary FEMA mapping for the Skykomish River and the Snoqualmie River. That's not the effective mapping, which I'll also talk about, the effective FEMA mapping, but the preliminary mapping that's maybe adopted at some point by FEMA. We were tasked on this project with developing hydraulic analysis to evaluate existing conditions on the site and to evaluate how the development might affect those existing conditions. We developed a hydraulic model, which is essentially a model that takes the flow of water in the river and translates it into where the water would go, what elevation the water would be at, how fast the water would be moving in those places. That's simply put what hydraulics is. So we started with the model, the FEMA model, the 2006. The study was actually done in 2004, 2005, but the FEMA model. We did site investigations. Through those site investigations, we recognized there were some things in that model that weren't correct. We fixed those for this project, and then we applied that model to evaluate the site conditions and the current conditions, and then the site conditions with the proposed development. The main issues in the hydraulics, we want to talk about a change in velocity and the change in water surface elevation. So I think you probably have our memo written in May of this year, which summarized our results. This is a table from our memo and just a paragraph that happened to be below that, which I thought was relevant here. So what we've done here is compared water surface elevations in the Monroe East area in the current condition, existing conditions, and then with the proposed development, that footprint of development, the fill that would be placed to raise that area above the 100-year water level, that fill would fill places where water currently goes, that water would be displaced. There's also proposed within the development proposal for cut compensatory storage to compensate for that fill. And what we looked at was how those cuts and fills together would affect water levels on this property. The conclusion of our study was that there would be a 4/100 of a foot rise if we modeled the condition of the existing conditions and then modeled it with the proposed development, those cuts, those fills, and that the velocities, which are essentially negligible here. They're very, very low velocities on the site through the slough, would at the maximum see an increase of 1/100 of a foot per second. But again, the velocities are down in the range of 2/10 of a foot per second. Very, very low velocities. As was noted earlier, this is not a project-specific EIS, so through the development of a project-specific EIS, compensatory storage or a change in the development plan would be options for reducing that water surface impact and reducing that velocity impact. But at these small levels, it's clear that that is possible to do on this site. I just want to, I know there's some discussion, some confusion over the water elevations and the modeling and the source of that. So I wanted to talk about three different things here on this site. This is the effective FEMA map, and you've probably all heard that term. It's the maps that are required for regulation for flood insurance. FEMA requires that communities use effective maps for best available data for regulations. But for flood insurance, it's the effective map. On this map, we have the slough here. The site is through here, and we see that it's a zone X. And what zone X means on the FEMA map is that's not in the 100-year floodplain. It's in the 500-year floodplain. I think what FEMA concluded when they did this study, I don't know exactly when this study was done, prior to 1999, was that the 100-year flooding wouldn't reach there because the highway would prevent it from reaching there. They didn't map it. They mapped it in the zone X, the 500-year floodplain. I don't know why, possibly under the idea that the road wouldn't protect it against that 500-year flood. Possibly it'd overtop somewhere and get there, but I don't know enough about the effective study there. This study, this is a map from the study that I was manager for in 2006, showing the same area, the slough, through here and around, coming back to here, and This map shows the 100-year floodplain that we delineated for this site. In delineating that floodplain, we didn't actually model the area north of Highway 2. What we did was we modeled the Skykomish River, and then in looking at this and in looking at the slough, we made an assumption that water would enter the slough from the east end, would travel through the site, and would leave the site on the west end. So what we did was we just took the BFEs, the base flood elevations, which are these swivel lines, and we just extended them. And we extended them here, and we extended them here. So we just took the elevations that were mapped in the Skykomish River, and we mapped those to the north of Highway 2 under the assumption that the water on the north side would essentially be equal with the water on the south side due to this flow path. Now, as I said, one of the things we did for this study was field investigations, and one of our field investigations, we walked that entire stretch of the railroad tracks, the highway, and what we found is there is, in fact, not a connection on the surface at the east end. So there is not a connection under the railroad at the east end that would allow water to get in here. So the flooding from the site is coming from the west end and actually backing up through those culverts. When the Skykomish is higher than the water levels on the site, water would back up through those culverts. As the Skykomish River drops, water would exit through those culverts. There's a culvert under the railroad and a culvert under Highway 2. So it changes the way that water gets there, although it doesn't significantly change the amount of water that gets there. Just keep this in mind, this picture, and then move to the figure that's in our report showing the area that would be flooded. So looking at this, we took the hydraulic model of the Skykomish River and we attached to it these culverts, modeled water through those culverts, how it would back up through those culverts, and then how it would fill the land. So still we see a significant area to the north of Highway 2 would be flooded by backflow through the culverts, water up the slough, and it would spread out very far to the east of the site due to that Skykomish River backwater. We've identified some features here, the culvert under Highway 2, which picks up water that flows between the highway and the railroad. It flows down towards the west and then comes under. There's that 3-foot concrete pipe culvert is sedimented in to about 18 inches from its top. There's a culvert on the site, and then with a little road, access road, there's a beaver dam on the site, and then two culverts at the downstream end, which is, again, where the water that's coming onto the site originates. So this was the existing conditions on here. Those lines, you can see, I colored like yellow maybe, that show that the maximum developable area or the area that is assumed filled. So in this case, this is the existing condition, so they're just on there for as you compare to this picture, which is what it would look like if those areas were filled. So then water wouldn't get in those areas. There were excavations in other areas that would offset that to some degree, and this is the result, essentially the same water surface elevation map there. I think that's all I have. If you have any questions for me, I could address, it was our statement about the LIDAR, so I could address that just briefly if you want.
Please go ahead. If you could.
What we had was, in addition to the LIDAR data, which is typically the best topography data we can get on a broad scale, we had site surveys where they had actually gone out and taken cross sections, where they had done spot elevations. But those are limited. You can only do so much field work like that. We compared those to the LIDAR, and what we saw was, in general, there was about that 0.6 foot difference. Now, our model, those cross-sections, that's what the model uses for simulating flows. But if we went to map that against topography that was different from the survey data, we thought that would be an inconsistency that we didn't want to have. So we just adjusted the topography by that 0.6 feet. Generally, that is a relatively small amount, but we felt for the mapping purposes, we'd be better to adjust the topography by that 6/10 of a foot so that our mapping and our modeling would be consistent, so that when we looked at where the elevations were, they would be consistent with that. So.
The issue I'm concerned about, or just curious about, well, and I hear about the dense vegetation, how that would be mitigated.
General, LIDAR does pretty good at even getting dense vegetation. We think of blackberries and such. In general, some of those returns will get through. As Craig said, the one surface is called a bare earth, and what that is, or sometimes called the last returns. So the first returns is the first things you hit on LIDAR. You might see even power lines overhead and stuff are in those first returns. The last returns is the last thing it hits. And you don't need, it's sending so many of these points that you don't need a lot of them to get down to that surface. So in things like blackberries, often you will get returns down to those points.
So if you saw a discrepancy of, let's say, 10 feet, where you're getting your last returns, and that would, you'd assume that that would be your baseline, your ground, and the first returns would be the top of the blackberry mound, and then you'd realize at the very least that you have a discrepancy there that would have to be...
Right, but that would be done by the LIDAR contractor who's processing that data.
Okay.
That's what the LIDAR contractor does. They get these returns, and I'm not a LIDAR specialist, but I use LIDAR data in almost everything we do these days because it's the best way to get broad-scale topographic data. But that's what they do. They post-process that data, and they look through that data, and they weed out the elevations, and they make the determination on how they find areas that might be too dense, that it didn't reach the ground. So.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Cutterback.
So can you just go back to what you said about adjusting the topographic, how do you say that?
Topographic.
Thank you. How you adjust that when you see that the data doesn't match up. What do you mean by that?
Okay, so what we had here was, unfortunately, if you have my, I don't know if you have my report, but I had one more figure and I didn't cut a picture of it here that showed all the spot elevations that were taken. And so you can think of the LIDAR surface as a ground surface, as physically something that is matching all the undulations in the ground, the slough, it's matching the hill slope and everything. And then we had maybe 100 points that were shot out there in the field on the ground, actually points. And on average, those were different by 0.6 feet. So what we did was we just elevated or shifted the LIDAR data to match those surveys. In our model, and in the back of my report, our model cross sections are there, you can see them. The model isn't actually modeling over the LIDAR surface, it's modeling over those cross sections, those actually field survey cross sections. But then when we go to map it, if we want to see a representation in two dimensions, what that looks like, we need that LIDAR data. So our feeling was that we were better to adjust the LIDAR to match those cross sections for purposes of delineating this floodplain here.
I have that. Mull over that.
Okay. I may have said the same thing. I don't know. Maybe I'm missing.
It sounds like kind of adjusting the data, and so data's data. So that's right. What I'm trying.
Right.
To
so what this is okay. Again, that data, the LIDAR data, is not used in any of the hydraulic modeling. It didn't form any of the hydraulic model. What it formed is this surface out here, and that data was collected by we obtained it from the Puget Sound LIDAR Consortium, where most LIDAR data is housed. But in this case, we had our water levels in our hydraulic model would tell us what elevation they got to, 65.31, I think.
Right, in that graph you had.
65.31. And we need to know where that 65.31 is on the ground.
Okay.
If we used the LIDAR just as it was, it would have told us that 65.31 was hitting the ground at a certain location. It would tell us where the edge of the floodplain was. But we felt like the 0.6 foot, even though it's minor, it was worth adjusting the LIDAR data down so that 65.31, if we looked at any one of our cross-sections, it would hit the ground at exactly the same point in the model as it did on the LIDAR data. So, it really, in terms of what we did, that really doesn't, well, I don't want to say meaningless, but the only place that affects is this picture right here. If we didn't make that adjustment, you wouldn't see the difference. It'd be too small. But there would be just a very fine shift in that map. It would be slightly smaller if we didn't make that adjustment.
Councilmember Kent?
Thank you. Just clarification. You adjusted it down?
Well, I said that, and I have to look and see which direction
That's one direction. But you're saying that the change to this map, we might see the edge either a little bit further out or a little bit
That's further. Right. There'd be places where, like, in areas here, it's very shallow. As you can see, as it gets to its edge, of course, it's very shallow. But for the most part, the water through the slough is much deeper, even the water against that hill slope, because it goes over, and as Craig's cross-section showed, it then goes up pretty steep.
Right.
You're not going to see any difference there. Out in this area here, yes, we might see a little bit of difference in the way it looks there, but across the project site, you'd see very little difference in the spatial of that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Osaka, is there anything further? Oh, thank you.
I'm a little slow getting on here, sorry. I'm Scott Brainerd, principal ecologist for Wetland Resources, and we did the wetland and stream work out on site. I've been working in the Puget Sound region on wetland stream and habitat assessments for over 20 years, and I'm a certified professional wetland scientist. We also had Jim Rockwell on my staff, who's a professional wetland scientist, and Merrill Kamowski, who's been specifically trained in wetland science, doing field work on this particular piece of property. So Wetland Resources was tasked with going out and identifying where any wetlands and streams and habitat areas were present on this particular property. As part of that investigation, we conducted an in-office analysis first. So we looked at existing available resources such as the priority habitat species maps, the National Wetland Inventory, the Soil Survey, and Snohomish County Resources to determine, what people know about this area, what's out here, what's been documented, is there anything that's really of interest before we actually went out and did the field work. We found a few things. I mean, we obviously found some mapped wetland areas and some mapped stream areas, but we didn't find a whole lot of priority habitats, which was quite surprising. There is some stuff associated with the river, but there's not a whole lot of terrestrial priority habitats in the surrounding area. Based on this work, we did go out and conduct our field work. We delineated three wetlands and a large stream system out on site. The stream was no surprise to anybody. Anybody who's driven by that has seen it out there. The assumptions that we have for our preliminary work was that we would have no disturbance on the north side of the slough. We would have no disturbance proposed within the wetlands or the slough areas, and that city's codes that are specifically developed to protect those critical areas are going to be in place and going to do their job. Let me just go to the map here. So back to our findings a little bit. The map clearly shows what we found. Wetland A is, sorry, in the way here. It's a large wetland system that's here and extends along the slough. So the slough, what most people think of the slough is two things. It's the wetland area and the ordinary high water mark of the stream. So they're kind of, they cross over each other, or they're combined for most of the actual slough area. But this is a portion of wetland A2. That's a portion of wetland A. Wetland B is a linear wetland feature that's located in the northeast corner of the property. And then wetland C is a small little guy here, which just basically is just slightly over the minimum threshold of what we would actually flag as wetland. And just kind of the informal criteria is what looks like a beetle. So that's the general size. It's a very small feature. And we have the slough, which obviously flows kind of through the center of the property from the southeast corner all the way to the southwest corner. The slough itself, so our assumption is a former oxbow with the river. I mean, it looks pretty clear that's what it is. And it is a shoreline state. So there's been some question about the slough, whether it is or isn't fish bearing, or whether we identified it as fish bearing, because in a report we did say that we did not see fish when we were out on site. We didn't. So what we do is when we don't see fish, we document that, but we evaluate the site based on the WAC, which establishes if a particular stream or feature meets fish habitat requirements. So this stream very clearly meets fish habitat requirements, so we assume that fish are present. In fact, I would be shocked if fish aren't in the stream. And we clearly state that in the report. Those parameters for this stream that it meets is it's greater than 2 feet wide, significantly greater than 2 feet wide, and it's less than 20% gradient. It's fairly flat. So if there's no question in my mind or in anybody's mind that this is a fish bearing stream. So that's documented in the executive summary of the report and further on in the report as well. So that our overall findings is that there's going to be no impact associated with the proposed rezone of the critical areas if the critical areas ordinance is appropriately applied. The wetland functions and values are not going to be significantly decreased by the proposed project, and there is going to be some potential habitat improvements. And I know there's been some discussion about the habitat improvements as well, and I think this figure shows, you know, how that can occur. There's a small amount of grading that we're going to do, or that could occur as part of the flood enhancement portion of the project. You can see right here that a small portion of the hill is going to be lopped off, and there's going to be, you know, basically a flat flood storage area. There's going to be a little bit of fill in this area to elevate that so you have a potential development area. But the main part of the enhancement is going to be the revegetation of this area. What this map doesn't show is that these little hills here are primarily covered with invasive species such as Himalayan blackberry and reed canary grass. So the Himalayan blackberry and reed canary grass are all going to be removed when that excavation occurs. And all these plants that you see listed here are going to be planted. Now those plants are important in that they do a lot of thermal control, which is important for fish, right? Keeps the water cooler so the fish have better habitat. It provides large woody debris contribution, so they fall down into the stream. The fish love that. It also provides habitat for terrestrial species such as birds. So you know, there could be, and there will likely be, if this project occurs, there will likely be a significant amount of habitat associated with the flood storage portion of the project. So with that, I'd like to open it up for any questions. Slides were short for a reason.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that, and I guess just in brief closing, I hope that that you've heard enough about the experts and what they've done and how much additional work is being done in the supplemental EIS to make sure that all the questions have been answered. I don't know if the council has more questions, but we've gone to great lengths to make sure that every stone's been overturned, or however you say that, whatever that thing is, and employed the best of the experts in the field. So I think I think we're very confident in the supplemental EIS. I think we've answered the Growth Management Hearing Board questions. I think we've gone far beyond what anybody anticipated for this document. But I think that's okay. I think we have really investigated the site. We've identified some opportunities. We've identified exactly what we're dealing with. And to future developers of the site, they know what they're getting into. City knows what they're getting into. Being a site located right along SR2, it makes sense that it be developed in some way, shape, or form. And I think that's put forth well in the SEIS. So if there's more questions, we can certainly answer them. I know we went further than Dave anticipated tonight. So I'll step back unless you have questions.
Thank you, Ms. Boyd. Councilmember Gehring.
Thanks. A couple comments and then a couple questions as well. First of all, thank you very much to everybody who spoke. Extremely thorough, and I'm certainly impressed at the level of expertise and the thoroughness with the results that have been put in here. It's amazing. I also appreciate the focus on the stuff that the board actually said we needed to work on. It's important to be focusing on the things that they asked us to do. I know it's easy to lump other things in there, but what we're here to do, and clearly what you did, is focus on the things that were remanded to us by the Growth Management Board, and it looks like you've done that very well. I appreciate that. Question, Dave, the final EIS, SEIS, what day, is that like the end of this week, or is that Friday when that'll be issued? What day will that be issued?
Right now, we're looking at issuing November 2nd, next month.
So next Monday, okay. And then there's a period of time before, what's a period of time after that's issued before council can consider it?
Typically the body has to wait 7 days before taking a course of action. And so that's why it's important that we get that issued November 2nd, so that the ordinances or resolutions that you consider on November 10th pass that 7-day time period.
And when can we expect to see findings and conclusions? You said the Planning Commission did those last night.
Yes.
And when will those be available for us to see?
At a minimum, they'll be available in your packet on November 10th.
Okay. And that's 2 weeks away, and I'm hoping that we can have them much sooner than that, like ASAP. I don't know that it would take 2 weeks to get those to us.
Well, I'm editing some of their edits, but if it's possible to get it to you sooner, that's not a problem.
It's
formal action, they've taken on it already. So.
Exactly, so it'd be, even if it's emailed, obviously include it in the packet.
Right.
So everyone can see it, of course. If it can be emailed, that'd be
great. I can get it to you this week.
That'd be my preference, to see it sooner than later.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So we have everything to consider. So, again, thank you for coming tonight. Outstanding, and I feel good about what I've heard, but we have more to consider. And so I do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. That's the end of our presentation for announcements and presentations. We're now moving on to comments from citizens. This would be a time where members of the public could come forward to speak to the City of Monroe on any issue except a quasi-judicial matter subject to a public hearing. Ms. Smoot, do you have an assignment? Mr. Anderson, please come forward and state your name and address for the record. Thank you.
Excuse me. May help me.
You put something, you lay something right in front of the thing. Kevin.
I'll be ready.
Yes, sir.
Laurel Anderson, 129 East Redmont Drive, Monroe, Washington. I feel blindsided tonight by these experts we had. We had a very nice planning session. We spent several hours, 3 hours, qualifying that. And I would like to ask some questions of your experts. First one would be the water science, or whatever they want to call themselves, and I'll start that by asking, how come you used a 2006 study when 1990 had much more velocity? And how come you can cut off one leg of the stream that is the Oxbow?
Point of order, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Anderson, this is for public comment to the City Council. So if you have questions, you can certainly put them on the record.
They are on record, sir.
I understand, but to turn and address the audience is different. This is an opportunity for you to share your concerns.
So we get one-sided, and we don't get, they bring the experts in now rather than the planning, and then we're supposed to sit here and take it, but that's fine. I'll start with something else then, but I expect my questions to be answered, and I'm getting full because they're not being answered correctly by this or outfit. There's no warranty implied in any of this. But here we go, the East Monroe Draft Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement. I stood before you during the 2010-2012 first FEIS and shared with you it was flawed. And we proved it. I stood before you during the 2013 FEIS and shared with you it was flawed. And we proved it. I'm standing before you tonight for the 2015 DSEIS, and I'm sharing with you it is severely flawed and we have proved it. The Planning Commission agrees with us and voted to deny after hours of testimony and evidence and cross-examination, which these people attended, but they did not have their representative. So we got no answers, no debate, no answers, whatever. But now they're all full of answers on why they didn't use the biggest flood, which is 1990, why they cut off one lake, why you just have a trickle of water coming in, how come you didn't drill from the top, many, many questions, but that's all right. So I'm asking you to deny this DEIS and end the hemorrhage of money spent on this non-project. No one is waiting to develop it. City taxpayers are not in favor of this special interest project. I would rather have the hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars spent on replacements or repairs of roads, sidewalks, water lines, etc. I would thank you for voting to deny this non-project issue. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. The next person that we have who's signed up to speak is Ms. Katie Woods. Ms. Woods.
Hello. Katie Woods, 17621 East Monroe. Good evening. That's what I'm here for. I put in your boxes today an event that is coming up next week, and it's put on by Coastal Community Bank, the city, the chamber, and the library. And it is for all business owners, and so I wanted to put an invite to all of you because I think it's going to be a really good event. It's we're trying to be a resource for all business owners in town and bring them all together as a resource network. And then we're going to do 5 TED Talks on how social media can help your business grow, how to attract and attain good employees, and how generation gaps working together, how you can communicate better. Our CFO is going to come and do a forecast for what the economy is going to do for 2016 and how it will affect the business community. So I just wanted to invite you, and I put them all in the box. And it's going to be catered by the Dashing Dutchman.
There you go.
Yeah, so it's a free event that we're putting on, and it says it's the first annual because we're hoping if it's really successful that we'll do it every year, and then we'll check with the business community to see what speakers they're wanting, and so we chose these topics because that's what we heard from our community. Just want you to come. So it's next Thursday at the Senior Center from 4 to 6.
Thank you.
Before you said that, and that actually was my question too, it said first annual. This seems like something that, if it is successful, and I certainly hope it is, I'm definitely interested, maybe even more than annual. I mean, this would be something that you'd want to, you know, that we want to do a lot. So
yes.
I'm excited about this. I mean, what a great idea, and I'm glad that you're out in front of it. That's really cool.
Yeah, something I've been wanting. Well, I've been talking with Phil from the library and
right.
the chamber, and just wanted to do something to bring the business community together. And so that's why we tell them. And with Phil, fall seems to be a good time because everybody's starting to get geared up for the new year and get their budgets together, and wanted to do something to help them prepare for next year. So.
And even if it's not the full meal deal, maybe if this is annual, you know, maybe even if there's smaller ones, that kind of thing during the year. I mean, it's your deal. It's cool. Yeah. I just think, hey, you know,
the better.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. That's right on. Very cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next person that we have signed up to speak is Mr. Kirk Scarborough. Mr. Scarborough, please come forward and state your name and address for the record. Thank you.
Good evening, Kirk Scarborough, 127 East Rimline Drive, Monroe. And I've sat and listened to this for about the last 2 years now, and I'm disappointed that we can't come together and help Pastor Minnick build his church there without all the fighting that's going on about it. Last night I listened to the Planning Commission, and I heard Mr. Stanger say that, well, people didn't seem to care that that slope could be degrading because they're still building houses on there. Well, and that the Modelsons, a well-known couple in the community, didn't seem to have any problem with Mr. Berger building that big house below them. Well, in fact, that's not true. Mr. Modelson either threatened or did file a lawsuit against Mr. Berger to make him build about $500,000 in retaining walls, one between Mr. Modelson and Mr. Berger. And Mr. Berger, on the bluff side, he put packs this big around, down 30 feet, staggered like this, all the way around the front of that property so it wouldn't slide. He spent a horrendous amount of money. And there's only been about three other houses that I see as I drive the bluff that have built there since 99. And this, and they had a chance to come back off the bluff a ways. They're certainly, I think, concerned about the slide. He said, why didn't we bring our experts in to refute the experts from Pace? Why, the answer right now is simple. We don't have the money. The only people with skin in the game right now is basically Pace Engineering. They're holding $140,000 or $160,000 lien on the property that the church is going to have to pay if they can sell the property. The church is, I don't know how much they're into it money-wise, or if it's just a debt owed to Pace. The citizens of Monroe are the people that are footing the bill for the city to do their share. So at some point, you all of us have been, all of us who live on the bluff have to get together, put the money together, and hire the experts. We don't know. The third thing was the word experts. I spent 28 years in the Navy, and again, you can understand the military background. The last 2 years, I've worked for an admiral. 1% of the officer corps in the military are flag officers, and they're usually the sharp of the sharpest. One of them taught me something early in my career. He wasn't a flag then, but he had a plaque on his desk as he walked in his office. Set a definition of an expert. Someone who knows more and more about less and less until they know everything about nothing. I'm not degrading the experts. The experts go to school. They get the degrees. Do we have to go find a different expert to find a different way? I don't know. Do we need to get there? You know, I've been walking around the town now for 5 weeks, and I've talked to a lot of people. I mean, people who come to them, they don't all come to the door, believe me. They don't all like me either because of what I know. But they, the people who have talked to me, I have not found one person yet who's for East Monroe. And for HBO, I think I have only heard of two. Water park that will be built out there. They're not against having a water park. I think they ought to go down to the other end of Highland Boulevard, dig a hole, run pigs in it for 2 years, fill it full of water, and make themselves a water park. But they think the tie lake belongs to the taxpayers of Monroe. They think that it's there for their serenity, and that putting in that park there takes away from the taxpayers who pay for that park. So those are the two big issues, and that's a 600-pound gorilla in the room. It's a 600-pound gorilla in the election race. And those are the two things that I have found. You guys have the power to change, fix them, help this man build his church out there if he wants, and get away from all this bickering and fighting like a bunch of schoolyard bullies. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there, that's the end of my sign-up sheet. Is there anybody else who'd like to come forward to speak in the back corner? Mr. Hammer? Please state your name and address for the record. Thank you.
Doug Hamer, 21122 Calhoun Road. I was going to mention something that Mr. Chessman said at the first planning commission hearing, and it's kind of the concept that's been pushed all along, is that Waterside Assessment Engineering is the same firm that was doing did all those studies back then. And I'm glad Mr. Carpack cleared that up, but it was not the same firm. It was Northwest Hydrology Consultants, a much larger firm and much longer business. But another thing, Mr. Chessman also protested at the same hearing, and the same protest was made last night by Planning Commissioner Stanger in his dissenting vote, that he had not seen any expert report from the opposition challenging Waterside Science and Engineering's or PACE's findings. Well, I found an expert report in the form of a PowerPoint presentation before the Skagit County Council on October 8, 2007, which, in my opinion, I'm being an expert, but in my opinion, within the space of 5 minutes, that presentation completely destroys the foundational argument of all the new analysis in the SEIS. The argument that not having a culvert in the railroad bed, and thus no hydraulic connection to the river at the east end of the slough, makes all the difference in the world. In fact, it allows them to lower the 100-year floodplain by almost 2 feet. You can go to Skagit County's website and watch the entire presentation. It's about an hour long, and it's interesting. But the 5 minutes of which I speak comes along at 21 minutes and 50 seconds. What is really interesting to me about this expert presentation is that it is Waterside Science and Engineering's expert doing the presenting. Jeff Johnson, the co-founder of Waterside Science and Engineering, was making this presentation as an employee of Northwest Hydraulic Consultants. And of course, I'm sure that's how PACE makes a substantial leap that it's the same firm. Mr. Johnson first describes a common way in which levees fail, and I quote, "When you have water building up on one side and you don't have water over here, you get what's called hydraulic pressure, hydrostatic pressure. Water can pipe through the bottom of the levee and it blow out. The levee just kind of disintegrates and you get a big hole blowing out of it. I think we can be certain that the railroad, BNSF, did not engineer that railroad bed to be a levee of any kind. Even though this SEIS would have us believe that it is an impenetrable levee at the east end by the slough, of the slough. No, I'm no expert, but I'm pretty confident that that stretch of tracks was not designed to keep water out of East Monroe proper. To the contrary, I'm sure the fundamental in its design is the hope of surviving a flood. The railroad would therefore like the water pressure on the north side of the tracks to be even with the pressure on the south side as quickly as possible, but without inviting the gushing vortex that a culvert would allow. Unfortunately, for that cause, the old riverbed runs right under that section of tracks. And you know what? The river is moving through there right now. But the best part of Mr. Johnson's PowerPoint presentation is, in graphic detail, he explains the modeling and calculations FEMA uses when determining the 100-year floodplain. He shows us the modeling when there are no non-certified levees involved, like, for instance, that railroad bed. He clearly states that FEMA starts with the assumption that those levees do not exist, so they're not even there. This raises the obvious question. If in the formula FEMA uses, the railroad bed does not exist, what possible difference could the presence or absence of a culvert make? I think the answer is obvious as well, at least to anyone but the experts. And the answer is zero. PACE's assertions in this DSEIS, as in the previous versions, are complete bunk. My girlfriend teaches communications to engineers at the University of Washington. But I have never heard her speak of a course where you are taught, if called on as an expert, the more outlandish your claims, the less likely people are to question your authority. I'm starting to think there must be a course like that somewhere. And I imagine the course's title is The Emperor's New Clothes, 101. I think it's long past time the city stopped playing the emperor in that storyline. I'll end with another quote from Jeff Johnson of Waterside Science and Engineering. FEMA maps address current risk, not future. But it is the future you need to plan for. Thank you.
Thank you. Did she?
It can't be my husband.
Please come forward.
I'm submitting.
Whoever wanted to come forward, so.
Put that on record. I submit it for
my name is Ed Sellers, 20930 East Rivermont Drive, Monroe. So please correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it sounds like Craig said that there were no core samples taken on the bluff. That's my understanding, and I would just like to note that, and I think this has been, I know it's been mentioned before, but that landslide, the recent one, was actually on my wife and I's property, and I welcome Pace Engineering to come take core samples on our property. I'm not a geotech engineer. I'm not an environmental engineer. I am an engineer of medical devices. I help design defibrillators and vital signs monitors, and I know that if we overlook one issue when we're designing a device, then it can come back to hurt us. So if it's something, and you know, and this is, and it can come back to hurt us, people can die. This is a case of landslides, and there is a critical component in my mind. We're not taking a core sample, and that can come back to bite us. I know that, you know, your test so far maybe suggests that that's not going to be the case, but I invite Pace Engineering to come take core samples on our property. Please do, as long as you don't think that doing those tests will compromise the slope. Please come take those tests so that you know the full picture of that slope.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who would like to come forward to speak to on any issue related to the city of Monroe this evening? Okay, anybody? Nope. Yep. Please state your name and address for the record.
My name is Ashley Zellers, 20930 East Rivermont Drive. I'll start by saying I think I need a bumper sticker that says I survived East Monroe. We haven't been here all these years as y'all have, so I sympathize and also appreciate just the opportunity to talk. I will say my husband stole my words, but you know, the thing that I've been speaking on a lot through this process is public safety. And the safety up there. I can see property rights. I can argue both sides of that. And actually, I spoke with Pastor, I'm going to mess up your name because there's just too many in, but Minnick last night, I walked up to my car and he was leaning on it and said, I disagree with you, but I don't want to run you over, so if you wouldn't mind moving. And he took that opportunity to spend about 45 minutes talking with me. I'm a pretty reasonable person. I want to see both sides of this issue and fully understand it because there's a lot of heart in this, there's a lot of conjecture, and then there's facts. And I think trying to find the middle ground in that as a newbie is an interesting journey. But I really wanted to know, because I think the thing I haven't been able to understand is why has he not built a church, right? That's why the property was bought. And just understanding that, so last night I really understood you to tell me that the property was bought as LOS, and that their goal was to keep a parcel or two and then rezone two parcels to sell as general commercial. And so it really triggered in my mind, well, that's not what's been put before the council. That's not what's happening. And I know that there's conjecture that Lowell wants nothing built down there, period. And then, but you can talk to people that say, no, there's things on file that say Lowell is fine with the church down there. And we can pinpoint this whole thing to Lowell, but there's a lot of us that are amped up about it. So I have a hard time understanding where that's going, but it was nice to hear a different perspective. And really, just we were honest, like, I disagree with you, you disagree with me, but just had a really good conversation about what that looked like. My big issue, though, back to the landslide, is that in the EIS, they state that they were not allowed access to the top of the bluff to do those. This is something the Growth Management Hearing Board called out, is doing landslide, but more research on landslide. And Pace calls out and says, we don't have access. Well, the Planning Commission asked, why not? They weren't able to get any answers. And it is interesting tonight that the experts are here because they haven't been able to contact them regarding some information. I wasn't even going to come to this meeting because it was my understanding that this was happening on November 10th. And I am not a conspiracy theorist, so I don't think every person in this room is against Rivermont Drive. Not, I don't believe that. I think There are people here that truly know what they're doing, did a great job presenting tonight. But the thing I have a really hard time with is, I could give you the names, and I'm only a year and a half resident, of at least 8 people that would let you do testing on their bluff. And I just really have a hard time understanding where the city is fighting for property rights for one owner, fine, without protecting lives of the people on the bluff. Do the test. If they come back and say, awesome, fine, nothing's going to happen, or maybe they'll say, you know what, you need to do a little more mitigation. You need to protect this slope like happened when the burger is built. But those tests should be done, and those are issues that just have not been investigated enough. And I'll be up here again, like I said, next week, because, or the week after, because I didn't know that this was coming up tonight, to just offer a little bit more intelligent take. But I wanted you just to know my heart on it, because I can see both sides. And I've done too much research on this and just drive myself crazy, and I'm not an engineer like my husband. I can't stand going through line by line stuff, which is like y'all are such a craziness. But my heart really on this issue is the landslide, and the fact that I really don't feel like that has been dealt into. And I don't think everyone on this council is bad. I work downtown and saw a mayor come in every week and try to get the person I work for to care about downtown and be a part of it. And, you know, the downtown revitalization you did, I mean, that looks great. The pink sidewalks, you know, I guess we're in Seattle, maybe salmon. You thought you were, like, dedicating it to the salmon run or something. But, in all honesty, like, that's an improvement that a lot of people were against. I was in construction, worked for Granite Construction, so I understand when you get grants and need to use those funds, which is something you really tried to convey to people. So, hats off to you on that. Pink, maybe, not next time. Great. But I just really would like you guys to take a look at the EIS, read through it, and see the inconsistencies, because there are people that are willing to allow you to do tests to protect their safety. Ooh, on time.
Thank you. All right, is there anybody else who would like to come forward to speak to this to council this evening on any issue? Okay, anybody? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move on to the consent agenda. Councilmember Camp.
I move to approve the consent agenda.
Second. The first from Councilmember Camp, the second from Councilmember Rasmussen. Any discussion on the motion to approve the consent agenda? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 6-0. The next item on the agenda this evening is unfinished business. This is AB 15-191, Discussion 2015 Conference of Plan. Update, Mr. Asaki.
Point of order. Yep. If you will look at your revised agenda on the page, there's an item that was placed before that added at the time of meeting. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
So everybody understands, I look at the online version, and because the hyperlinks work better on there than on here.
Okay, so we'll scratch that, and we are still going on to unfinished business. This is item number one, discussion, second addendum to the concessionaire and property use agreement with H3O for cable wakeboard park facilities at Lake Tai Park. And Mr. Brazel.
Mayor, excuse me, point of privilege. Can we turn on the fans?
Turn on the fans? Yes.
Please. Thank you.
Yes, we will turn on the fans. Don't turn.
This has it.
This has it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. Because I was absent last week, I got with staff and kind of reviewed the discussion on H3O. And then staff helped me put together what I perceived as the last best and final offer that Council had put forward. At least that's what I distilled from the discussion that Council had. I then put that forward to H3O, and they were right on the phone to call me and go over each discussion point that Council had expressed, which was much appreciated. And following that discussion, they went ahead and responded in writing to each of those points, some of which they agree with, some of them they have some issues with. We can, this evening I put it in, or have it in front of you. Their rebuttal is in red. And some of the key points that I can express this evening are in regards to the rent deferral and the past rent. They have a new investment partner online, and there's some concern over the back rent and ability to pay for that and make this project work. And so what they've offered here is the $45,000 worth of vouchers in lieu of that. Obviously, council had some discussion on that point. Another key point would be the bond and the two bonds that council decided would be appropriate, one for removing the towers and one for removing the building should it not be completed on time. The discussion with H3O, basically what their defense was is they had said that when the original $100,000 was came up with, the piers were going to be concrete, and since that time the technology's changed and they're going to be auger piers, which are cheaper and easier to remove versus jackhammering concrete, obviously. And so the discussion went like this: they felt that $100,000 could possibly cover the tower removal and the building removal if the bond was structured right. I worked with our staff to kind of figure out where the $100,000 came from, and one thing that I did express to H3O that they had an engineering estimate that showed that $100,000 covered both items. Potentially, the council may consider that. Obviously, that's up to council's final say. There were some other issues that were in here in regards to the start date, and then, of course, the deadline to construct phase two within 2 years. H3O expressed that they need at least 5 years of revenues before they can move forward on that. And the thought process there is that they would just reapply for the permits necessary to construct phase two at the time within that 5 years when they're ready to build. In talking with our staff, there is a potential that the permits would be easier to obtain for just phase two because the majority of the water, the work in the water right next to the shoreline could be done in phase one. So there's a chance it would be simpler second go around to get the permits just for the building. Not a guarantee of permits, but again, that was something we discussed. H3O is here this evening. If you were to ask questions, that's up to council. Obviously, that's your format of running the meeting, but they are here this evening if you want.
Thank you. Councilmember Gehring?
Thanks. Gene, I just wanted to get clarification on what you just said about it's easier to get the permits in phase two. Is that, I didn't understand if that's a good thing, a bad thing, if that's an easier thing. What kind of a thing is that with it's easy when you said it's easier to get permits just for phase two?
I'll try and speak to it briefly, and Brad wants to jump in. That's, sure, that's great too. Right now, we set a timeline to operate within the permits that are issued.
Right.
And the permits that are issued right now encompass both phase one and two, because it's supposed to be one process. And so the majority of the dirt work and putting the pylons in and stuff like that for the towers in the water happen in phase one. The only things in the parking lot improvements, that type of stuff, happens in phase one. And phase two, there'll be, of course, some excavation for the building, the foundation, that type of thing. And that is outside the water. And then, of course, there is some stormwater work that needs to happen.
Pretty much, yeah. Basically, the hard permit is the Army Corps of Engineers permit.
Right, right.
And that is related to work in wetlands. So if they structure their project right, then all the wetland work is done before the expiration. Getting a building permit and a shoreline permit wouldn't have to go through the Army Corps process.
Okay.
That would just be hearing an examiner here for a shoreline permit. So that we anticipate would be simpler, assuming that the regulations don't change and, you know, the Corps jurisdiction gets farther away from the water or something like that. And then
Simpler, and that's why I wanted to get to. Simpler for them and simpler for us at the same time is kind of what I'm understanding you saying. That makes it simpler across the board. I just want to make sure what is simpler.
To obtain those permits.
Yes. Okay.
The regulations and the approving agency.
They don't have to get a permit.
Because getting
a permit from the Corps is the issue. Doing it the way that you had suggested is easier because you don't have to deal with the Corps, and that's right. The bottom line of what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. thanks. I think I understand that.
Councilmember Hanford.
Thank you. Well, first, I just wanted to I'm glad that H3O is in the room. It was, just to be frank, I was fairly disappointed last week when we were trying to hammer this out and get down to the bottom of it, and we went to executive session, we came back, and we had left. So I'm glad that you're here now, but disappointed that that happened, because some of this could have been avoided, possibly. A couple of questions that I have. Under construction deadlines, phase one completion, July 1st. If I'm reading this correctly, they said not acceptable target is for May-June, but legally H3O and its investors require 9-4 completion date in the event of unforeseen delays in construction. So I'm not quite sure what legally, why the word legally was used there. And so I'd love for someone to address.
You can go forward and state your name and address for the record. Thank you.
Hi, thanks. That one's actually a simple one.
I'm sorry, can you state your name for the record?
Chris Hogan here with H3O Partners.
Thank you.
The only reason, well, this is not a legal document, but we're creating a legal document. So if we put a July 1 date legally in the contract and we slip, then legally you'll have termination rights, and we don't want there to be termination rights unless we have more time. You can see what our target is to do something to make actually June or May to get a full season in. And that's what we want to go do. And we want to get construction off even before the February 1 date that's in there too. But we just don't want to make any mistakes this time around, and which a date that could hurt us. And we think it's pretty reasonable if there was some unforeseen thing that pretty much impacted our summer, we still wouldn't want to see the agreement go bye-bye.
Sure. So I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the tape from last week, but that was one of the things we talked about. And in our discussions, the idea was that if it comes to be, you know, May, and it's, you've already broken ground, you're all, you know, there's major transformation taking place, and it's looking like the July 1st is not going to work, then it's a matter of just coming to council and asking for an extension. And if all that is going on, the council's not going to say, no, put it all back. You know, we don't want you there anymore. I mean, I'm having a hard time seeing. That was our discussion.
With all due respect, okay, this even goes back to the first agreement. If we didn't have it up, we were going to start having to pay rent on a particular rent commencement date. And there was an informal agreement that, well, that would get pushed back if there was unforeseen circumstances that we couldn't get the park open in that time frame. We live by that in a very expensive way by not giving ourselves more explicit in the legal document the ability to have that date moved if we weren't open for business. We don't want to make that same mistake. Our investor, certainly behind us, doesn't want to make that mistake. And we do apologize, by the way, for last week miscommunication. We thought we were only allowed to be here for the 5 minutes that we were able to speak. We did not know that we were going to have an opportunity to be with you, answer questions, and have discussion. We would have more than happy to do that. I made a drive all the way from Missoula. Believe me, I didn't want to leave for just 5 minutes.
Sure.
Okay.
So that was one of my questions. As far as the last issue, which was the bond, there's I'm open to what you said, Gene, about if they can get an estimate. Like you said, we were just estimating, so if there's a more accurate number.
So on the towers, and I'll let Brad give more detail on that, but we do have a formal estimate from the tower company.
Oh, great.
We had an opportunity to speak to Sesotech. I'm Brad Smith,
Mr. Goldman. I had the opportunity to speak to Sessom Tech several times recently, and we've been discussing the issue of the bond and how common this is throughout the parks that they see in the country, and really what the amount is that is expected amongst different parks. I really want to try to get an accurate number, and you know, Gene and I had conversations about the $100,000 figure and where that came from and so forth. But talking to them, they do see bonds being very commonplace issue, and they've addressed it through a different proposal, which I'm going to throw at you tonight as maybe being an option that could help us out. But they typically see $25,000 to $35,000 is the cost of the removal of the tower system. And again, obviously, it's dependent upon where in the country that might happen.
I'm sorry, how much was that number?
$25,000 to $35,000 was kind of their range. Now, one thing that they put out was that given this bond issue and how it impacts the ability of these parks to move forward sometimes, is they've actually come in as a manufacturer and offered to put up what they call a brokerage agreement, to where if indeed a municipality wants to take advantage of something like this, but yet still needs that protection for the removal of the tower system, they're willing to act as the mediator and broker. So in the worst case scenario, that park up and moves and leaves, the towers are left in the water, which again are a valuable asset, they are more than willing to come in. And for that agreement of typically taking the resale, percentage of the resale value of that tower system, they will handle the entire removal of it and take that on, and obviously in lieu of having to put up a bond. Now, it's kind of a nice way to approach this. If you think about it, it allows us to, again, have, you know, if you talk about a bond, obviously that is an annual renewal every single year. It's quite an impact to a business carrying forward 15, 25 years, potentially, on the length of this agreement. So if we can obviously work around that in this fashion, give you the protections that you need, it certainly allows us now to address the bond for the phase two development, which I understand, and I totally understand they're, you know, building that halfway up, and we need to put that site back to the original condition. This allows that to happen as well. So, and then again, it is a concern that if it wasn't a part of the original agreement, it is a cost to us in the long run, but hopefully is a solution that will really handle both sides of this. So, just something I'll put forward.
I appreciate that. I am open to that, and if it's said, if you have the estimate, that all sounds like a great way to go. Looking through the rest of these, I'm assuming that's, we can just go down the list. Thoughts?
Yes, yeah. You got it.
Okay. So, under the phase two, not complete by March 18th, on page two, as far as, I mean, our goal there was to, because the permits expire at that point, we don't want to see this drag on and then have the permits be denied, and so then that kind of throws us in a loop. So I'm not too, unless there's some other opinions and other insight that I'm missing, I'm not too fond of extending that past what we originally proposed.
That's one reason I placed a call to Brad and to Gene to really discuss and understand, you know, the permit issue. What are we up against here? How, you know, are we limited to that date exclusively, or can we let that expire and go ahead and reapply to complete phase two at a later date? Because the real issue here is about how phase two is funded. 2 years and two summers, when it comes right down to revenues, is not enough to complete that project, and therefore relying on going back to raise more money, whether through a loan, through more investors, which again is going to water down the equity side of things even more. You know, it's just not an avenue that we can take on. Yeah, our current investors are not willing to go down that route. So it is a very, very important topic. I'd like to say we can just stick to that date. And certainly, if indeed our numbers allowed us from a revenue standpoint, and we blow it out of the water, and we can accomplish that, we will do it because we want to. We want to complete that phase two as soon as possible. It allows us to create the most revenue as well. So, you know, certainly we're incentivized to make phase two happen as soon as possible. But again, we need, for the same reasons that we need that date protection, we need the same time to also make sure that we raise the money to complete that project in full and not to get halfway through it. You know, we're not going to start it until we have the money to complete it.
And then as far as the back rent, there seems to be, I mean, I've been in favor of this since day one, but there seems to be a disconnect between of what your understanding is with the rent and what the rest of our understanding with the rent. We've never said you don't have to pay rent anymore. Stop paying rent. You're going to be forgiven all the rent while we renegotiate this contract or look at redoing this. And so your last proposal to us before we came together last week said you deny, I don't have the words in front of me, but it was pretty strong wording that you deny that you owe us any back rent. And if you look at the contracts, it's very clear. We talked, and you explained, I believe it was you explained to us that you just can't afford the rent right now with no investors and no working agreement. And so you wanted to renegotiate the contract. And we said, yeah, we're open to renegotiating the contract. Let's talk. And so that's very concerning.
Chris Hogan, want to address this one? First of all, regarding wording that goes back and forth, every document is public. I would have rather had been in a business conference room and we could have a conversation back and forth. For obvious reasons, nobody, the city nor H3O, wants to go ahead and acknowledge certain things that can come back to them. We believe we're in a good faith negotiation that entered into last January. The beginning of that conversation was always the premise that way back then that future rent would be deferred for some kind of consideration. 10 months has passed since then, but if we go all the way back to then, the $45,000 of vouchers, if we had had the agreements back and forth back then, would have been for deferring rent from last January until we get open. That would have been how much we wanted to compensate the city for. Unfortunately, what our investor can't understand is how 10 months has gone by and how come the contract hasn't been terminated. Well, we both had a good faith understanding that keeping the contract in place was going to be the easier way for us to go ahead and move forward. We actually gave you an agreement and a proposed agreement in April after we had our first kind of conversation is to terminate the first agreement and move on with a second agreement. Your legal and your counsel came back and said, let's just do an amendment to the original agreement. It's easier for the city. So we're stuck in this kind of good faith kind of negotiation where we do want the compensation through the vouchers, which we discussed way back when. Actually, back then it was giving you guys days. Now we've converted it into vouchers to make it more of an individualized basis. But we don't want to not have the city get the consideration. It's still the same thing. And from our investor's perspective, he doesn't want to see cash out of pocket. That, I mean, every dollar out of our pocket creates a jeopardy for some impact of the business not getting off the ground right. Whether it's in marketing, whether it's in staffing, whether it's in a construction thing that we didn't see that happened, that's going to be that value of money. Mm-hmm. And so not putting immediate cash out of pocket that doesn't go toward the new funding of the facility is of utmost interest to him. And we still want to negotiate in good faith. We still want to go pay through the voucher system or the Monroe Days or whatever it might be. The consideration for, you know, from last January until we opened the gate, which if you do the math,
The rent on that is less than $45,000. We wanted to give a number that was higher than what the rent would have been for the citizens of Monroe. If you follow.
That's all. Thank you. Thank you. Councilmember Kemp.
Thank you.
My question is, under the Senate sewer issue, we'll do what is legally required by the permits. What is legally required by the permits? Mr. Pilot, I assume you know the answer.
Mr. Pilot.
According to the city's building official, any temporary restroom is required to be connected to the sanitary sewer system.
So
they're agreeing to it.
The temporary restroom facilities will be connected to the sanitary sewer system.
That's the city's understanding, yes.
All right. Wait, maybe not.
Just to address that one, when you got those words right there, conversations hadn't taken place with two people.
Oh.
And so when that was came to you to be expeditious, we were basically just trying to say that we're going to do whatever the permitting process makes us do. And if that means we have to connect in the sewage, we would. We probably prefer to wait to phase two to go do that, but if we don't have a choice within our permits, then we won't.
Okay, my concern is I do want... I just have a picture of a regional attraction with Sandy cans out in the front. It just does not work.
Well, actually, we don't want that either.
Okay.
And our view of the world would have been, if you think of those big, nice restaurant trailer kind of things you might see at a school say or something, it would be a full restroom. It just wouldn't, it'd still be being right. Stored, but it wouldn't be a little porta potty.
Okay, just wanted to be on the same track. Thank you.
You know, I guess I'll kind of, I had an opportunity to sit in a meeting about this and with Brad, we discussed. It's my understanding that it was the employee restroom that was the necessary component of that, and that could be inherent into the temporary building. But at the time, I understood it to be you could be a tank emptying system or a hookup, that the Santa Cans or honey buckets were not an option, so I certainly understood that, but it was that incorrect?
That's my understanding of what the building official said is that it had to be connected.
So, okay. That's what it states.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, Councilmember Cutterback.
I have a couple of questions. Do you guys mind coming back up?
Parties,
whomever. So, as far as the removal, the bond removal, it makes sense to me to have a bond that is the cost of the removal. So, if there's a good estimate on that, but I would like it somehow to factor in inflation over the years.
We're going to propose that the bond was required that at least get reduced to $50,000, and that just seems to be a number
sure.
that easily covers with any inflation.
Okay.
And I think that's a manageable amount for us too, if indeed that was a choice over the broker agreement with the manufacturer.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense.
We prefer the broker agreement. We don't have to worry about inflation or anything because it's no matter what the cost is,
yeah. they'll keep it.
They manage it.
They're gonna work it out, and then they're going to get their pound of flesh on the resale of towers.
But the reality is if indeed that ever came to pass, there's value in that system, so
sure.
it's much more likely we would take care of that, but it's a fallback, if nothing else.
Okay, it's an easy one. So then, it's been interesting because the last, I don't know if it's been 6 months or longer, you have come back and said that you have an investor, you're ready to go. But what you really meant is you're ready to go only on phase one and you only have an investor for phase one. Because what I'm hearing is your investor is not investing in a phase two. They are.
So to restate that a little bit,
okay.
So going all the way back to January, when we started this whole process over again and created a two-phased approach, the two-phased approach was that we would need less money
sure.
to start the business. We would make revenue off that business over a maximum of 5 years, maybe less, and that the business would be able, in and of itself, be able to fund the phase two and or would demonstrate earnings power so we could go get loans from banks, not necessarily go find new investors. And that's why we always convert this into a two-phased approach. And that's what we learned from the first time out there when we were asking for the full thing at once. People didn't want to take that risk. And if they did, they would want to take so much of the company that it wasn't worth our while. It was an impasse. It wasn't going to work.
So for this one, I didn't vote for the original agreement. Obviously, I had some issues with taxpayer money and using Lake Tai and what the use was. But I did vote to forward our first, our original, our offer that we sent back to you, because I thought it addressed all the concerns and points. And what you sent back does not address my concerns and points. The building was always a very big point of the original contract. And I think that saying that you need 5 years to build that second phase building, which is not a substantial building by any means on that site, is too long of a time for me. Plus with the risk of you could walk away and that building never be built, and we don't have any protection there. So I think it's the construction deadlines and that factor into the building in phase two. I go back to our offer that we sent to you about a month ago. So,
can I address that before you move on?
Sure.
So, and I understand this may or may not be an agreeable to
sure.
you, but when we look at consideration and fair value, we had a 25-year deal. The building, the parking lot, the bioswale, all that all made sense over 25 years, along with the royalties and the rent that all goes along with it. If for some reason we had to shrink this down to a 5-year deal and we couldn't go forward, the building is not part of that, but you still got an improved parking lot, you still got improved water shore stuff, you still got potentially, if you want to keep it, any docking that you would want to keep left. So, and you still get the rent and you still get the royalty. So basically, we still, you know, as a mutual risk, mutual share in this, is that, yeah, if we get the building up, that buys us 20 more years. And that's great. I mean, you got, the city gets the building, we get to keep it in business. We all want that. But for some reason, whatever unforeseen circumstances happened and we couldn't go forward, the city's still not getting, they're still getting all the improvements that are outlined in phase one, along with the
other stuff. Phase one, but not the building
yeah.
per se.
But quite frankly, we would have done,
have to do,
we couldn't do a deal.
Come in and offer $300,000 to $400,000 of investment in the public properties. Yeah. Plus revenues along the way.
We don't get 5 years use it.
There's definitely some value there that you're getting, so. I understand the value of the building and
right.
the end product for sure, we get that, but don't forget, there's two levels of improvements to the site that are slated to happen.
So I keep looking back at this deal and going, if it was my own property, in the history of what has happened, would I be making this deal? And the answer is no. And the residents have entrusted me to make decisions up here, and when I look at the history of this, and the not paying rent over a period of time, you know, the agreement continuing to change, it holds me back from moving forward in any type of amendment or new deal. I was one of the council members who said, you know, best course of action is really to terminate. And I hear your investor said that. That really made the most sense to me over a year ago, when there was trouble paying the rent and this wasn't going forward and you didn't have investors and you didn't have a timeline. So, you know, that's just my opinion. The last piece I want to address is the vouchers for the $45,000. And we've had a lot of public comment, our time up here speaking publicly about the rent and the money that is owed the taxpayers. I mean, that's, you know, you signed an agreement that had a rental agreement to pay that money. You have not been paying that money. You are not caught up in the rent. Again, if I had a building and I had a business or I had a contract and it was my own property, that would be done. There would, you know, this would not be continuing on. And it's hard for me to justify with promises of, you know, it's going to be great, or the city's going to get improvements, or there's going to be revenue. We've been at this for 5 years, and there hasn't been any of that, and there's been a lack of even adhering to the original contract of paying the rent. And I get it. things change, landscape changes, permitting took too long, whatever, you know, the rationale is. It wasn't a real great business plan in the first place. That's why I didn't vote for it. I said, this business plan doesn't make sense to me. There's too many unknowns. Great idea, cool idea, would be cool if it could work, but this doesn't make sense to me. The numbers didn't add up. The research in it didn't add up. You took a risk, and it's not panning out. To go back to the $45,000 and the vouchers, I look at this and you know, I want cash for the city. I want a payment of the original contract. Get caught up. Get to where you're supposed to be. If we're going to move forward as partners and collaborators, and we're going to have this great partnership, prove that you can have a partnership. Prove that you can, you know, hold your end of the bargain previously. That hasn't been shown. Not good business sense for me by any means of the city to continue entering into an agreement with partners that haven't been able to adhere to original contracts or make an adjustment, terminate the contract, come back. So those are my questions as a business person and someone who deals with contracts, deals with other businesses, to see kind of the history and to see how it's unfolded and not adhering to a contract.
Well, I'm really sorry to feel that way.
Yeah.
I really thought it's not just you, it's a group and a group.
Totally.
And as a group and a group, I really felt like we were working in good faith over the last 10 months, that there really was no expectations to have cash payments during that time frame while we were in good faith. And in that 10 months, it's beyond my imagination that me, Chris Hogan, would be sitting here starting in January and having this conversation about an agreement 10 months later. Somehow, both parties have morphed, and we haven't gotten this resolved back in March or April, where it wouldn't have been such a bigger issue. So,
when we approached the city initially, I have revisionist again history here. We approached the city, explained to them that we were not going to be able to continue the way things were. We were looking for a solution, and at that point, it was expressed, well, let's explore the phased approach. And there were a lot of issues to deal with as far as finding out if that was even an option.
Sure.
So it took some time. Didn't expect it nearly this amount of time.
Sure.
But indeed, it was agreed upon that, hey, if we can come current and then let's look at it, we'll hold off until we can proceed with finding out if this is a viable solution or not.
Right.
And here we are.
And just for the record, we talked about way back, the way to go forward on the deferred rent. Way back when, we said we would, now, but back then it wasn't in arrears. Back then it was forward, and we always wanted to give compensation for that. And we proposed that way back then, and there was never, and really until the last 3 or 4 weeks, to say, no, that's not something we want. We actually want now back rent.
So for me to be very clear about my position and my opinion, because I like to be transparent, is I believe that the back rent has to be paid in cash. Future rent, as I agreed when we sent forward that our offer, I guess proposal a month ago was future rent is something different, vouchers, those things, because it's agreed upon. But if the park never opened, those vouchers are meaningless. And what you're proposing here is you want to do the back payment and the future payment all in vouchers. Well, we haven't had a history of that there's been movement in this park getting open. If we agree to this, it's saying that we relinquish forfeiting the claim, the back rent.
It's a trade.
Right.
That's what it says.
Yes.
But why not want that?
But
that's all it
right.
says.
Right. But you've got to understand that the park never opens. These vouchers are meaningless to the city, meaningless to the city of Monroe, meaningless to the residents, and that's who I represent and who is owed this money is the city, the residents, the taxpayers. So those are my concerns.
The whole approach was, how can we get the park open? And that's what we're trying to do, too. So we're asking for that bit of help.
Yeah, so I understand.
Can you defer it? Possibly. It's up to you.
You are all about how to get the park open. I'm about the best interests of the city residents and getting the best deal for the city and the residents. And whether that is opening the park or not.
I hate to say this, okay, but if this doesn't go through, when we don't have an investor, then all we have is a legal claim against a bankrupt company.
Yeah.
And so, either way, the city's going to have a tough time on that. I'm not proud of that, but that's what's going to happen. And what we're really going to, the best for everybody, is still, if it's about making money and making revenue, is get the park open. Not necessarily, if we shut it down, you have a better way to make money on the waterfront, then I get that. But
yeah, I don't like going into a deal that the best case scenario is, you know, this, which isn't such a great scenario.
Best case? I don't know what that meant, but okay.
Yeah. Thank you, that's it.
Thank you. Councilmember Gary.
Thanks. I'm trying to make sure for the best for city residents, and that it opens. That's what I want to have happen. I've said that as well, along with Councilmember Hanford and some others. Want to see this happen and want to get over roadblocks. We've got a couple roadblocks, obviously, as we're talking about tonight. Want to make it happen. I'm not sure. I don't know if the rent deferral one is one that we can get rid of. But I want to try and figure out putting that one aside, you know, all the other ones. The ones that we've talked about so far we talked about the brokerage agreement, but if actually the number's less on an actual bond, I think that's great. If it really costs less to, you know, it gives you protection, gives us protection. I mean, that's the bottom line there is, you know, the condition of the contract is, hey, if something doesn't work out, you know, it needs to go back to the way it was, right? Noting that there will be, you know, the improvements that you talked about. There's going to be a pad. There's a number of things that the city does walk away with. And if, you know, 50 grand or whatever that number is enough, then, you know, then I think that's great. But we'll need to see that. But hey, if that number works great, you know, I'm on board with that.
By the way, if we do the brokerage agreement, you guys are okay with that as being for the towers? We're still okay. When we get to phase two, we can do a one-year bond in case, you know, for $100,000 or whatever,
right?
For when the building's going up and if something goes wrong and it's only halfway out. So we can do a bond for the 1 year that we're doing the phase two, just to make sure you're protected in case it doesn't go through.
The bottom line is the city doesn't need to pay, isn't going to pay to take that stuff down. That's been on you. And whether that's a brokerage agreement or a reduced amount bond, whatever that is, that it needs to be, I'm open to it as long as, you know, you're paying for it, not us. That's the bottom line. I don't think that's ever been a point. You're doing it. If that works better and it's guaranteed that the stuff's coming out and it's not a dime to us, then I'm good to that. Secondly, the 9-4 completion date. That was cool. September. We had some. I understand that there can be delays, but we ended up at that July 1st date because it was kind of a meet in the middle. Like, oh man, you know, if let's say you were going to do January, you know, as we were sitting here talking last time, July 1st seems like a very reasonable date. That seems like there would be a little bit of a buffer there for you. And as Councilmember Hanford pointed out, that there's an opportunity there to come back to council and say, I mean, you know, we're almost there. You know, we need another 2 weeks or we need another 3 weeks. To me that seems pretty doable.
I just can't go on. So here's the deal.
I want to be able to talk about that. Yeah.
I'm more into the legal side of things, the financial side of things, that's my value. And if I went all the way back to the first agreement, there's things that would have never gotten in there from our perspective.
Okay.
It's protection. And I can't have a handshake on July 1st and have a new council that wants to go ahead and take the thing down and have an ability to go, oh, they didn't get up by July 1.
And I get you. I get you there.
And for me, you know what? After the history of this whole thing with things that get delayed that are outside of your control and my control, all it takes is one city official not to give me conditional use and just keep pushing me back. And I'm like, whoops. So, I mean, I'm still at risk if I have some city official that doesn't give me conditional use for some crazy thing I don't really understand at this moment in time. And
September 4th.
I'd like you to open on July 1st.
June 1st.
And I was okay with the September 4th. I'm okay from the standpoint of I really do not want you to have to need that buffer.
I don't want it either.
And I know you want to open at that time.
I want that because we lose the whole summer.
There was a majority of people that weren't comfortable, as we discussed last time.
I mean, quite frankly, I'd like to put December 31st as a buffer because once I start spending my money, I want to make sure I open the thing. But I didn't insult you with that. I need a little bit more than a tight timeline.
Yeah. And I get that as well. I'm not sure that a majority are, but I get that. I want to make sure I communicate that. Then I think the two-year thing in the March 18th, that was based, as we discussed earlier, and I understand it now, doing the permits in a different order, you can avoid having issues with that date. That date came from, that's the date that the Corps of Engineer permit
was. Right, it's actually a conditional use.
Is it conditional use?
Well, shoreline conditional use? Yeah,
but the one that's the
Army Corps.
It's the Army Corps. See, that's right.
That's the year.
So that's where that came from.
17.
It's been a lot longer. That's like 10 years.
Okay. And if there's a way to avoid having to do that, then to me, I think, that's where the two-year time frame came from is you have permit issues. If that's no longer an issue, then I'm okay with a different time frame. We want the building. The building's important. We said that all along. It's important. You want the building because there's a revenue incentive for you there to get that building done. It may take longer. It may not take longer. If that's no longer an issue with permits, I can be a little bit more flexible than that. I'm not sure a majority are, but certainly I can. But again, sooner the better because it is something that is important to us, something that all of us have talked about. We need it there. That's the completion of the project. But I want to make it work at the same time. So I'd like to see it happen. I want it happen. There's still the one that's on the front page here, though, that seems like I don't want that to be a deal breaker. Feels a little bit like it might be, and that makes me uncomfortable. And I don't want it to be, but I don't know what to do there. I don't know if that's a discussion here.
The only compromise I can offer to go back to our investor on is if you want to reduce these vouchers and you want to have less on the voucher side. He's not going to put money down up front. I might be able to convince him to do is to take it off the $45,000 credit on the utility on the back end. So we have less, and there's still cash in your pocket. Doesn't solve your problem of if we never open. But it is, if you don't want vouchers and you want cash, we can try to take it off of the credit that we get from the utility.
I agree with Councilor does have a point with. I mean, if it never opens, the vouchers aren't worth anything. So then there's been nothing. I mean, I think there's that's a legitimate point.
I know. I'm just saying.
Yeah, and I know. If
we don't get this through, don't open. You're going to have to decide if you're going to.
I'm for you. And I want to make one. Right. I'm just making sure you know that. There's a couple of them here that are like, how are we going to do this, right? And so, trying to figure that out. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Rasmussen.
Brad, one quick question for you, if I may. Mr. Felberg, the mentioning of the towers with the new technology, being lockered in instead of blocked in, sounds intriguing. I just want to double check, does that have any effect on the current permits or anything that's currently in place?
We don't think so.
We don't think so. But there's possibility. I mean, we talk of unforeseen issues that may come up, and when Gene mentioned that new technology, I mean, honestly, it seems very intriguing. And just off the surface, intriguing. I kind of want to look into it a little bit more, but I'm just wondering because there's obviously been a lot of work done on H3O's part, and of course, the city's part. You know, is that going to extend this out even further with permits or this or that that neither party is seeing. So that was one question.
There's the 45-day review period that the Army Corps of Engineers has their permit. Once the H3O buys their wetland credits, they're supposed to notify the Army Corps of Engineers and they have 45 days to give approval to start construction.
Okay.
So whether or not the new towers, since they're no longer in the water, they're all being on the bank, the Army Corps will consider that they're impacting wetlands more, they need to buy more wetland credits. We'll have to wait and see what the Army Corps of Engineers does when they come out and get final approval.
Okay. Actually, the towers still, base will still be in water. The anchor points are on.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you. You know, guys, I appreciate you being here. You know, I've been very consistent in my position. I mean, there's no secret about it. You know, just based off of the conversation from last week and this week, you know, hands down, the back rent is definitely going to be paid. I mean, you're talking to a guy that spent 15 years in the banking financial service industry and writing construction loans and business loans, and the first rule they teach you is cash is king. And, you know, that back rent's got to be paid. And, you know, when it comes to future rent, you know, I'm still not in favor of the vouchers being used in place of rent. Again, in my mind, cash is king, and I think the cash to the city has much more value than someone getting admitted to the door. And, you know, that's my opinion on it. I feel that benefits the city more. You know, I'm intrigued on the bond, the piece of it. You know, if it gets to that point, I would be interested to see the more confirmed numbers on that and investigating that. I'm not saying it'll change my mind at all, but I am very intrigued by it.
The brokerage part or the removal bond?
The removal bond. And you know, the 2 years for phase two, that is the other area I'm really having a hard time being flexible on. Just simply because, I mean, this whole time since 2011, this council, even before I was on here, was, you know, we can do it quick. We can, you know, and even when we spoke in January, at least I heard the impression that, you know, as long as it goes through, this is going to be very quick and so forth, and so to hear 5 years, I'm like, well, you know, we've been told all along that, I mean, even when this first came out in June, and the RFP, I remember you and saying, build in October. You know, so and now I'm hearing 5 years, and it's like, well, I think reasonably it can be done in two. I know you guys hope it's done in two, but to me that kind of keeps the incentive in favor of the city to keep this thing rolling, keep it going. So, that's all I have.
Thank you. Councilmember Camp?
Thank you. I agree with the points that Councilmember Gehring was making earlier. Sounds like we can address the other issues except for the item on page one. One of the points you made, and I think it's valid, $45,000 worth of vouchers from a company is a gamble for the city, which is really less than, well, it's more risk than I'd like to see. However, if this doesn't go through, you said we'd be attempting to get money from a bankrupt company, which would give us zero money anyway. If there is room for negotiation or some way for accommodating the rent issue, I'd like to see it attempted. I don't know what's possible, and I think that would be a conversation between our city administrator and whatever parties involved. The key point is, the city is at some risk, and there's no guarantee that we'll get the money either way. But I would like to see the opportunity for us to make the whiteboard part work, have the opportunity of perhaps making some money. We knew this was a brand new adventure, and we were stepping out into the unknown in a lot of ways 5 years ago. I didn't expect so many different types of things to have to be accommodated, but we got through most of them. I would like to see the opportunity. I would like you gentlemen to have the opportunity to produce this wakeboard park. I'd like to see it succeed. Personally, I think it's worth the risk. I do, like I said, I do have a problem with $45,000 in vouchers for a company that may not work or it may not happen. But on the other hand, if you're going to go bankrupt, we're out the money anyway. Those are my points. I would like to see some negotiation, see if we can overcome that issue. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So let's go through this. The council last week voted on a counter, and I want to make certain that staff has got direction to work on things. I'm going to take things, I guess, from the back page because it seems like that's where it's simpler.
Yeah.
So basically, for the issue of the removal of the towers and the temporary building, basically we're looking for a hard estimate of the cost to remove it. We're looking at options, including a brokerage agreement. And so if there's no objection, I will ask staff to get some more information about that and come forward with some language that we would bring forward to council for final approval to fold into an amendment, to, you know, into the amendment. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Is there... Okay. Working backwards then... So I'm getting mixed messages on where folks want to go with phase two not complete by March 18th of 2018, six month termination. I can either ask you to have somebody propose a motion, or we can just keep it the way that it is. Councilmember Cutterback?
Just a question on that. So what H3O had proposed was us giving them a three-year notice. So if we countered with the six-month termination in March 18th, I believe.
Yes.
So I guess if council doesn't go forward with what the six-month termination in March 18th, we need to have discussion, I guess, including back to their original offer. See what I'm saying?
Right.
So I just wanted to make sure that we could cover both as we discuss this. That's their offer, is the three-year termination. So
one of the things we can do, too, is rather than getting really specific this evening, because I know this just dropped on the agenda essentially today, is we can come back at a future agenda, maybe the 10th, maybe the 17th of November, and just sort of winnow things down. So this may be one of those gray matter items that we come back and discuss at a future council meeting.
Could I suggest that it's as soon as possible? I mean, every...
Right, it
every
can't
meeting
be the third.
Yeah.
Pushes everything out, right?
Yeah.
So if we're going to do this, then we need to do it ASAP, which means the 10th. If I may suggest that.
I'm fine with the 10th.
Yeah, it needs to be as soon as possible, please.
Yeah,
okay.
Definitely.
Okay. The next item then would be the July 1st. Now, this is one that there was some discussion on. What do you want to do, Council? July 1st, September 4th? Somebody like to make a motion for a number, or do you want to come back and discuss this on the 10th? Councilmember Camp.
Thank you. I move that we change the date to November 4th.
September 4th. I'll second that motion.
I have a first from Councilmember Camp. I have a second from Councilmember Gehring. Any discussion to move this to September 4th? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Okay, motion passes 4-2 with Councilmembers Cutterback and Rasmussen voting against. All right. Temporary restrooms, we'll keep the language the way that it is. Okay, so the postponement of rent. So we have the rent deferral and we have the postponement of rent consideration. And so let's go ahead and we're going to take the rent deferral first. Is there a desire from council to change what has been countered at this time?
I thought per Councilmember Camp's point, doesn't that involve a legal discussion as well,
right?
Most likely? And I think that
was
kind of what he was getting to.
We can bring that back when we have an attorney, probably hopefully the 10th.
We'll need one that night, right? So there we go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What is that?
We will have one.
Okay,
we'll need one that night.
Okay, so we will, is there any, Councilmember Hanford?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I don't think we can do that. So.
Okay, so we'll bring...
What we've got written down.
You're saying stay with what we got? Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jeff has, everybody else.
My thought.
Okay, so is there... So, Councilmember Hanford, do you want to go ahead and just... is there a motion to change what we have? Okay, I do not see a motion to change what we have, so we're going to stick with what's there for now. Okay. You have the ability to bring it back up on the 10th. We're just trying to get direction for staff because there is no meeting next week to make certain that we're taking care of things. Okay, is there anything that you want on the rent consideration, the postponement of rent consideration? Do you want to just keep it as it is for now?
I mean, I think the $45,000 voucher thing was great. I mean, that was awesome. With regard to that one, I think everybody was in, most everyone was in agreement with that. As for that section, we thought vouchers was great. It was a very acceptable idea. Everybody thought it was great.
Okay. Councilmember Cutaback?
Maybe not everybody.
Well, but in that they say, with accepting that 45, they're putting the two together.
That's correct.
Forfeit any claim.
Which we would want to leave it as it is.
You're suggesting leave as is here, not correct. What they're...
Combining. Not combining the two, because we just said we're going to need to have a discussion about this
sure.
one. Some people say leave this one as it is.
Right.
If there's anything to be done, it requires a different discussion.
Right.
But this one we would leave as it is.
Out of agreement with you. Proposed.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
I just want to make sure I understood you. Okay.
That's what I'm. If that's what you're saying, then we agree on that.
Twice in one night.
It happens more than you say.
Asmussen.
Happens all the time.
Thank you. Just a second.
Councilman Rasmussen.
Thank you. Just for the record, I'm still in opposition to using vouchers for future rent. So
understood.
Sorry. Not everybody. And that, yeah.
That's
fair.
It might be obvious. I'm just going to ask the question. If you do go one way with back rent and you go another way with deferred rent, would you propose a number less than 45, because that 45 was for both. So
the rent deferral is going to reflect what's due to date, according to the date that's in here. That's the way that the response was, I believe. And I think that what you had done is taken the 45,000 and combined the two together.
Right. Well, above it. I'm going above it to combine numbers.
Understood.
Yeah. Indeed.
Okay, so we have direction for staff. When we come back to the extended agenda, we will put this on for the 10th. Your attendance will be appreciated on the 10th. Anything else on this topic, Council? Okay, let's go ahead and move on to unfinished business item number 2. This is AB 15191, discussion 2015 conference plan update. Mr. Osaki.
See you later.
Great, thanks.
Excuse me, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. Actually, this will be relatively brief. I just want to, first of all, on your dais tonight, you have a notebook, and it contains part of the comprehensive plan, and we'll talk a little bit more later on about how much you have and probably more importantly what you don't have. But I just want to give a little bit of background about where we are right now. The Planning Commission made a recommendation to the City Council last week. Going back to where we were on April 3rd, 2015, the city released a draft EIS and a draft comprehensive plan. There was a 60-day comment period specifically for the EIS portion. It's a little different type of EIS process. There was a 60-day comment period on the EIS that concluded in August. While that was going on, the Planning Commission had three meetings where they had public hearings, and that was April 20th, May 4th, and May 11th. They took public testimony, and during the course of those three meetings or three hearings where the testimony was open, they had five people testify. And then there were actually five comment letters that came in during the course of that 60-day period also as well. And when we move along in this process, we'll make sure that you get the Planning Commission minutes from those meetings and all the correspondence that came in during the course of this process as well. And then between May of 2015 and October of 2015, the Planning Commission deliberated on the plan during the course of 18 meetings. And what you have tonight represents the Planning Commission recommendation on part of the plan. Now, they're done with the entire plan, but you have part of the plan. And it includes, also in your packet, you have the Planning Commission findings. So the basis for why they recommended, why they did, and what some of the key issues were included in the findings that are in your packet tonight. So what you have in that notebook are basically what the Planning Commission focused on. And those were chapters 1 through 10, and I've talked a lot about chapters 1 through 10. Introduction, vision, policy, framework, land use, transportation, economic development, housing, parks, capital facilities, shorelines, and implementation. Just for your information, the items up there that have a little asterisk by them represent actual elements that are required by the Growth Management Act. All the other items are optional elements that the city felt was important enough to include in the comprehensive plan. Chapter 2, I've talked a lot about Chapter 2. That's the vision and policy framework. Includes the vision statement, 8 goals, 220 plus policies and 24 action items, and what an action item is and what a policy is and what a goal is are defined on page consultant number. There's basically little dots, so you gotta go over 2.5, so basically 2-5, 2.5 is where those items are defined. And even though it's not quite structured this way in the packet or that notebook that you have, at the very front, what we did is we just put the vision statement, we took it out, put it at the very front, and there's 8 goals are also up front, just so you have an idea what the big items were in terms of the framework that drove the Planning Commission recommendations. Now, what you don't have on that notebook, but what's online, and we'll eventually get these to you, and it's probably going to triple the size of your document, State Environmental Policy Act, there's actually an EIS that goes with this. That's Appendix A. Appendix B is basically a glossary. Appendix C is a summary of what happened, the update process, the public participation. Appendix D, E, and F, we'll get those to you because you probably want to take a look at that. That's the transportation plan, the economic development plan, and the parks, recreation, and open space plan. There's a capital facilities, public service, and utilities appendix that talks about private utilities, the fire district, and then Appendix A or H is all the technical background for the water, sewer, and stormwater plan update as well. And then just for now, just so you have a chance to take a look at this plan document, I want to get back into Chapter 2 because much was talked about at the Planning Commission about making Chapter 2 very readable, cross-referencing it across different elements, and making sure that it's tied to different goals. So this is just an excerpt from Chapter 2. I believe this is the housing element. All the policies are numbered, so they start from 001 to, I think, 220-something, and they're just sequential. In the housing element, it begins to pick up at about policy 105. You have the policy. There's a column on additional policy reference, and what that basically means is that some of these policies fit under different goals because the Planning Commission felt that the same policy could help implement goals, different goals within the plan. So when it says additional policy reference, if you go, for example, on policy 105, it says additional policy reference P056, P085. If you go look for policy 56 and policy 85, it's going to be the same policy, but just in a different chapter. And then the Planning Commission wanted to make sure that the public had a good understanding of which chapters within the plan these individual policies help implement or are tied to. And so if you have an X in the column, it means that that policy has some strong relationship to that particular chapter. So there's a lot of cross-referencing going on in Chapter 2. So really, that's all I wanted to talk about tonight, is just to give you an idea of how to kind of work your way through some of the key parts of this plan, which basically is going to be Chapter 2. I've talked to the Planning Commission, and they would like to come and maybe give a short presentation and maybe to respond to any questions that you may have of them in terms of the work that they've done. it would actually be a good idea for the city council to hold a public hearing on the comprehensive plan. And I say that only because from the time we started on April 2nd to the time we are now, there's been a fair number of changes in terms of the policies and items like that. And it would just be fair to give the public an opportunity to have a hearing that they can come and comment on any elements of the comprehensive plan. Now, having said that, we do have some notice requirements, some minimum days to get notice, and I'm getting the sense that I'm not quite sure where this November 24th meeting might be going or not going. So, and then I'm also seeing that we couldn't have a hearing those days anyway, but I'm sensing that the remaining days in your November docket are going to be pretty, going to be dealing with some issues that are going to deal with some, to have a fair amount of public comment. So December 1 might be a reasonable time to actually have a public hearing on the comprehensive plan.
Sounds good. Moved.
That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Councilmember Gehring.
Thanks. I love what I see, and I love Chapter 2. Chapter 2 is fantastic because, it's again, it's exactly what we've asked for. It makes it really easy to read. And I love the map at the very end because it... it makes a little bit more sense, so I'm glad they got around to updating it for us. It's awesome. And I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And thank you, the Planning Commission, again and again and again for all their hard work. Mm-hmm. 18-plus meetings on it. So, yeah.
Thank you. Councilmember Camp.
Thank you. I just want to echo what Councilmember Gehring said. Appreciate all the hard work on it. Do we have a hard date for the comprehensive plan to be sent to wherever it is?
Well, the last date that the City Council passed a resolution saying what would be our completion date was December 1.
Okay,
so we're going to be close.
But if we have a
hearing on the 1st,
right,
we'll need first and second reading of the ordinance. Probably puts us into mid-December.
Okay, but there's no issue with, I mean, other than any issues we currently have because
right,
we're late. Okay. I just wanted to check. But thanks again. And the Planning Commission. Great work.
Thank you. Councilmember Cutback.
Yeah, I want to thank you also. It looks great. And again, I've said this before, but I really appreciate the formatting, the readability, the usability. I think it makes a big difference. I think it's going to, you know, somebody, a resident could pick this up and go through it and get a sense of you know, the plan for the city or a
councilmember.
But I love the vision statement, love, you know, how it outlines where the policies are, and so thank you for all the work. Thank the
Planning Commission, right. Thank
yeah,
you.
They did a great job.
Thank you. Councilmember Hanford.
Thank you, yes. I love the professionalism of everything and just outlined great. Is there, what procedural-wise, if the public hearing is on the 1st, could we do a first reading on the 1st as well, later in the meeting?
I'm not familiar with council rules enough to know the answer to that question.
We certainly
will get the answer. I think the answer is yes.
We can do it the same night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As long as there is a public hearing, that was the whole point.
Yeah. Yeah. I would be interested in that, just because we're trying to shoot for the first.
Right. You know,
it would be great at least to have one reading
started.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Council? All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Osaki. The next item that we have on the agenda this evening is final action, AB 15192, ordinance number 014-2015, setting property tax levy for final reading. Ms. Nelson.
No changes from the last council meeting when we had the first reading. Levy includes zero increases except for new construction.
Thank you. Councilmember Hanford.
Move to adopt ordinance number 014-2015, fixing the amount of taxes to be levied by the city for calendar year 2016.
Second.
I have a first from Councilmember Hanford, a second from Councilmember Cuttaback. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion passes 6-0. Thank you. The next item that we have on the agenda is Councilmember reports. Let's go ahead and start off with the City Council Legislative Affairs Committee. And who's the chair of the committee again?
Right.
Councilmember Davis.
So we met again tonight. 2 weeks ago, during our regular meeting, we handed out the resumes from the three applicants for the lobbyist RFP. And we scored those and brought those back today, and we've eliminated it down to the two, or we wanted at least to bring it down to two opposing groups who What we plan to do is on the 10th, have them here for you to interview.
And so when
before
right
six.
Oh, okay.
Right. When we get to the extended agenda, you'll see there's a special meeting that's now being proposed at 6 p.m. on Tuesday the 10th, and we'll come back to that under the extended agenda discussion. Okay, anything further from the Legislative Affairs Committee?
We'll just have the information, and you'll be able to ask the questions to those two applicants, and then we'll vote on it. We'll bring it back a week later is what we talked about. So.
Okay.
But anyways, what I would like to say is we got three applicants. All three are excellent applicants. I appreciate the time and the effort that they put in the application process, and I think you'll see they're very qualified. The two that we did come up with. And I thought that all three of them were very qualified, and any one of them would have done a great job for us. But as far as experience wise and things like that, it came up to just the two. But just to repeat, I appreciate the effort that went into that application process and all those that did apply to it.
Thank you very much.
I'll finish.
All right, let's go to individual councilmember reports. Councilmember Herring.
Thanks. I'd just like to say congratulations to the Monroe High School volleyball team. The ladies are doing amazing. Qualified for districts. They're going to be in the playoffs. They already won the league. It's just a lot of fun to watch. First time ever Monroe has done this well. Doesn't mean they'll go on and win the state title, but we're certainly hoping that they will. It's just a blast to watch and so good for the school. And cross country as well, both the men's and women's teams have qualified for districts, and the ladies finished third at Wesco, which is a huge accomplishment. Monroe had 15 kids go out for cross country 5 years ago, and this year they had 41. So it's a growing program, near and dear to my heart. So it's really cool. And the football team has one game up. I mean, just a good time for sports at the high school. And exciting to watch our student athletes do well. And I know everybody up there is excited about those things. And rooting for the Royals. And by the next time we have a meeting, the World Series will be over. So hopefully they're the world champions. had to bring my hat.
Thank you. Councilmember Davis.
Nothing tonight.
Thank you. Councilmember Camp.
So we're going to start having sports paraphernalia sitting
on
the counter.
If Camp was here, he would have his sports paraphernalia.
I will start bringing my own sports paraphernalia. Nothing really to report. I would like to say that I was disappointed that I was not listed on Ms. Hendrickson's phone list. I saw the mayor's title there, but unfortunately Jim Camp was not.
On what?
The phone list that you had on Facebook. Your message? Never mind. Okay. Oh. You got it.
Now she knows.
You had to have seen it. Thank you.
That's all. That's Member Asmussen.
Only thing is, next week is election night, and congratulations and good luck to anyone that is out there running, and those that aren't but can. Encourage you to get out and exercise the privilege and right to vote and do our part. So that's all I have.
Thank you. Councilmember Cutterback.
Today at, I think, 3:30, I attended the Monroe Downtown Association board meeting, and I just was invited and went just to check it out. It's a great group. They are looking at coming, and they're going to call Jean to come and present to council, and they are looking to get certified in the Main Street program, which I'm sure everybody knows, and the mayor's been keeping in great contact with them. They reported that the director of the Main Street program for the state is going to be here December 1st, so they might have her come to a council meeting and talk about just kind of do a little bit of an assessment of Monroe and what it looks like for Monroe to become part of the Main Street program. So I'm just really inspired, motivated that we've got a great group of volunteers down there taking the lead on really making downtown that Main Street core area, beautifying it, making it more viable, attracting more business. So I think this is the first time I was originally involved in the Main Street program when I first came to town in 2004 and actually took the training. and through this time, this is the first time sitting down with that group that I've really thought we've got a really good opportunity, and this is a great group. So I think some things down there, if you know, they get funding and things are going to move forward with this group, that's what I feel. So it's very heartening for that to happen. So, yeah.
Thank you. Councilmember Hanford.
Yes, thank you. A couple things. I wanted to just disclose that I was elected to continue on the Board of Trustees for the Employees Community Fund of Boeing. So starting my first full two-year term. So I was appointed before, so now I was elected. So, there's a ribbon cutting this coming Friday for Housing Hope.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll actually be wearing two hats, because before I joined PCF, they had granted $40,000 for all the appliances in those units. So it's going to be a fun day. Hope you can make it. 11:30 to 2:30, and the program's at 12:45. So, of course, everyone's welcome. And that's much it.
Thank you. Let's go out to staff. Mr. Worthen. Ms. Nelson?
Nothing
tonight. Mr. Osaki? Chief?
Today was the first day for the new world computer-aided dispatch and reporting. And the world is still together.
So it's the same world.
The same world.
Same world.
And it was really interesting to hear those on the air this morning that had participated in the training and wholeheartedly accepted the change, and the ones who had not. So, anyway, it's doing good. We're very pleased.
Thank you. Mr. Proudberg.
Nothing tonight.
Just a couple things for me. You'll notice in Monroe this week, I just gave some of the updates from some of the things I did last week. A couple of items of note. I met with Representative Scott on Thursday, had a nice discussion with her for probably over a half hour. We talked about State Route 522, we talked about 191st Street extension and constructing a second roadway to improve access to Trumbly Hill. You know that is Frontage Road 7 or something like that. We also talked a little bit about the left turn from Kelsey northbound to westbound Highway 2, right in front of Rite Aid, between Rite Aid and Denny's, and the fact that I can pretty much count on only getting three cars through there.
Yeah.
And she went ahead and contacted somebody from DOT over the weekend and copied me in that, so I appreciated that. Also, I have made arrangements to meet with the legislative district representative, Muscoso, I think is his name, from District 1. The 522 improvements, as Representative Christensen pointed out, have been completed in our legislative district. I didn't realize that the district line ends at the Snohomish River. And so what that means is that to get funding for 522, it's going to require an interest also from people in that legislative district. So I'm going to be meeting with Muscoso, I think, right around the 1st of December, and we'll be meeting with folks in the interim to continue to collect information that we can share with him. Following the meetings that we've had with the two representatives and our Senator Pearson, staff and I are gathering information, a packet of information that we're going to send about 191st extension, the road frontage, some information about the synthetic turf fields, and also some information about the 522, completing 522. I think that's that meeting. I also met with the Chamber Board. Had a nice meeting with the Chamber Board on Thursday for lunch. One of the things that we talked about was the Downtown Association. There's still us getting to a point where there's an understanding that by having the Downtown Association, you could have an association that focuses just on the downtown. And one of the things our chamber has historically done is spent a lot of time on the downtown. By having a downtown association that qualifies for, you know, different funding and has a different purpose and all this other stuff, the chamber can not only take care of the downtown, but they can also broaden into promoting the city as a whole. So there's some conversation that we've been having around those points. It's a really good synergistic relationship that the two organizations can enter into. I've got some things in here about the Sky to Sound water trail concept, and there's a letter that we got that I've placed there before your places. And I think that's about it for right now. If nobody has any questions about what I've just gone through, we'll go ahead and go to the extended agenda. Gene. Actually, next week. The 10th of the extended agenda.
Yes. Yeah. Sounds like the discussion came up while I was out of the room, but yeah, we have a meeting starting at 6 o'clock for the lobbying services interviews.
So before we leave that, I know that this is a different time. Is everybody that's here able to make 6 p.m. on the 10th? Okay. Oh, Councilmember Rasmussen?
I may be a little bit late, but should be shortly after 6.
Okay.
And will we get the candidates an email ahead of time to review, or...?
Yeah, you'll be getting a packet of information probably the Friday prior, just like we do council stuff.
Okay, thank you. That's a good question.
If we can get it to you sooner, we will. Mr. Brazel?
Thank you. The packet's going to include the overall scoring for all three, so you'll be able to see where everybody landed, and then you'll get the packet for the two that will be interviewed. And that's basically what they submitted for the RFP. In addition, questions. So if you guys have questions in your mind right now that you would like to ask, please email those to me. Staff has prepared some in advance, and as soon as I see those and they're through HR and everybody else needs to weigh in, I will email those to you in advance of the council packet. So if you guys have any concerns or questions or want to add on, just email that back to me, and then that will be in your packet. So that's going to be in short order.
Yeah, and to that end, if you can get those questions to Gene maybe by Thursday morning, that should be enough time to go through, consolidate, and put them into the packets. Councilmember Cutaback?
This probably is in the scoring, but were references called, and is that part of the scoring? Did someone talk to someone about these candidates?
I'm disappointed.
So there's been no reference calls. I don't know if that's something...
Typically, we do that following an interview.
But it looks like it's on the agenda to maybe make a decision.
It's not on the agenda until the 17th. We moved it out.
Oh, okay.
My apologies.
Okay, I see here, lobbying firm selection.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me get this straight, because I was going to suggest not doing it in the same night, so we're going to interview on the 10th, do whatever background work we might have to do, our questions that come up to check, and then we'll make a selection on the 17th.
Correct.
Okay.
That's the hope. And certainly if council isn't ready to make a decision and you want us to do the reference check, we can do that as well, you know, and then come back the following week.
Yeah, I mean, there's no urgency, but I just wanted to make sure there was time in between the interview to the time that we made our selection in case there was follow-up questions. Thank you.
Okay, anything further on the 6 p.m.? All right. Let's go ahead and do the November 10th.
Okay. November 10th, 2015. Public hearing. We've got the 2016 budget, first public hearing. Under announcements and presentation, the Monroe Historical Society will be here.
That'll be Tammy Kenny.
Tammy Kenny, she's awesome.
We've got the consent agenda under unfinished business. We have the 2015 comprehensive plan update. We have the East Monroe Comprehensive Plan Amendment and Rezone, first hearing. The lobbying services we just discussed will move to the 17th. And then the P4 committee reports. I'm not thinking canceled yet.
Gene, is H3O on there?
Oh, we'll put H3O back on there.
We certainly will. To that end, I wanted to thank council for letting us put that on last minute. We've been really working hard at trying to get this thing rolling, so I appreciate you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sooner than later. Okay, does anybody have anything further for November 10th? Okay, seeing nothing, let's go on to the extended. Okay, does anybody have anything for the extended agenda? Okay. Seeing none, I have no other business for this evening. Councilmember Gehring?
I may move to adjourn.
Second.
I have a first from Councilmember Gehring, a second from Councilmember Davies. Any discussion on the motion to adjourn? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 6-0. Thank you. Have a great evening.